Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away, huh. But I feel alright, I feel alright tonight. I feel alright, I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient tales.
Alright, alright, alright. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the WGN Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. And also the Monday morning movie reviews will begin in just a few minutes. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress will join me to review all the new movies, and we will also talk about box office as well. That's all coming up here on the show. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk or text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show, and stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Also, subscribe to our podcasts. Every second of every show is podcast, and you can subscribe. It's free. And you can go to iTunes or wherever you're going to get your podcast. Subscribe. It's free. It'll automatically be sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So there it is. Monday morning here. We're back. I'm happy to be back. Man. that cold really knocked me out, man. So, Tom, it's Tom Hush, my great producer.
Hey, what's going on, man?
Hey, man. Yeah. It was brutal.
Well, you know, sometimes it just gets the best of you sometimes.
Man, oh, man. And I'm still not 100%, but, oh. It was ridiculous, man. I mean, ridiculous. I think I went through, like, four cases of puffs in 2 days. Yeah, that was a cold virus thing that really knocked me out, man.
Well, it's just that time of the season, you know.
Yeah. I mean,
especially over the next couple of days, it's gonna be pretty cold, pretty rainy. I know on Tuesday. So.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, wash your hands.
Take your vitamins.
Take your vitamins. Wash your hands. That's all I'm saying. Yeah. No, I you know, I hate missing work. You know how that is. But man, Friday I was in bad shape. I just was like, I can't do it. So,
well, we missed you. It was we had a good time, but we missed you.
Yeah. Well, who filled in?
So
it was Pete, right?
Yeah. Pete took over for the first hour, so he just kind of continued going on because he went on 11 after the after the Hawks game, and then Mike Heideman. Yeah.
Yeah.
Me and Mike Heideman were hanging out.
All right. Did you do it in this studio?
Yeah. Right out of here.
Wow. Okay.
We wanted to keep as much of it the same as possible.
Okay.
So.
All right. Well, I'm back, and it was not a pleasant weekend. That's all I'm saying. So, and I didn't even get to the movies. So, like, all the reviews are going to be by Eric and Steve, because I didn't even get to the movies. My parents went. Parents went to go see the Addams Family, and they enjoyed it. So, hey, it's my favorite commercial, the Kit Kat commercial with the pumpkin. That's kind of how I felt over the weekend. So, anyway. Well, I'm back. It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We've got a whole bunch of other stuff that we're going to be jumping into. Pulp Fiction opened on this date in 1994. We'll reminisce about that, and then we're going to talk about some of the best opening scenes in movies. Robert Forster passed away.
Yeah, that was...
78 years old. Terrific actor. Yeah, so we'll talk a little bit about him as well, and in some weird sports superstitions. There's a lot of superstitions out there, but a lot of them are connected to sports. Like, people really do take their sports, you know, pretty seriously. I remember when I was over at a, during the 2010 run for the cup, for the for the Stanley Cup.
Right.
I was over at my buddy Benji's house, and he had a massive TV, and he had a TV in the bathroom, and we were watching the Hawks playoff game, and you know, people were standing in the same position that they stood the day before. You know what I mean? They wore the same clothes, that whole thing.
Right.
You don't want to change anything. You don't want to mix it up. It worked. So the Hawks were down, and one of our friends was in the bathroom, and he was in the bathroom, and when he was in the bathroom, the Hawks scored. So when he was walking out of the bathroom, we're like, you have to stay in the bathroom.
You're relegated.
You have to stay in the bathroom. They scored while you were in the bathroom. You have to stay in the bathroom. See, and he stayed in the bathroom.
What a champ.
Yeah. So.
Well, I made the mistake once of, I did not know about the superstition. I don't know how I never knew was, you don't talk about a no-hitter in progress.
Oh, no.
I can't remember what it was. I can't remember what game it was. I'm pretty sure it was the Cubs. But I think I showed up to my buddy's place, brought the potato chips, brought all the snacks. I was like, hey, guys, how's going on? I was listening to the game on the radio. Looks like we're going in for a no-hitter, and I got screamed at.
You don't do that, man.
No, it was bad, and the no-hitter got blown, and they all blamed me.
Yeah, of course they blamed you.
And, yeah. So.
And you especially don't bring it up to the, like, if you're a teammate.
Oh, yeah, no.
You do not say anything, you know, especially to the pitcher. I mean, yeah. No, that's a no-no. All right.
I got learned.
You did. All right. In the newsroom, it's our good friend Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Hey, good morning, sir.
How are you?
Great. Doing good.
Did you have a good weekend?
It was good. It was all right. Yeah. I didn't do much other than I met with an old buddy of mine I haven't seen in a while in the Fulton Market District. That was fun. And then Jeannie and I stayed inside because the Chicago Marathon was Sunday. And so we just stayed inside and kind of watched that. And yeah, it was a nice weekend, though.
Yeah. Yeah, it was good weather for the marathon, because sometimes, you know, you don't want it real hot, you know, because sometimes it's like 70, 75, 80 degrees.
I think the wind kind of was a challenge to some of them, just from hearing them talk after the race. I think the wind and, you know, up that hill on Roosevelt, the last stretch was kind of a challenge to them. But yeah, I think you're right. Most of them, once they got running, I think it was pretty cold while they were waiting. They corral them in. Pretty tightly while they're waiting, I think it was pretty cold then.
I have nothing but admiration for anybody who would run a marathon. Because there's, you know what I mean?
Oh, for sure.
I can't even imagine it. But God bless them, you know? So, and I know people who live for that stuff.
I had a view from my apartment, especially using binoculars. I could see the finish line. And, man, Jeannie and I were just like, for hours, I would look out the window again. And there's still a ton of people coming in, because you could see those. They wrapped themselves with those foil,
foil
blankets to keep warm, and so it was just a ton of them still coming in.
Yeah, well, it's you know, it's huge every year. Every year, I had a friend, I had a friend run it, and we went down and supported him, and boy, he was sore. Man, was he sore afterwards? You know, obviously you're going to train and work out and everything, but yeah, he did not. He wasn't very good at walking like the next day.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Really tough.
Painful the next day, yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, listen, we're here. It's a Monday morning. We got the Monday morning movie reviews coming up immediately after this break. And again, if you want to jump in at any time, it's 312-981-7200. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke, and we've got a lot more to talk about. So stay tuned, everybody. And thanks to the guys for filling in for me on Friday. And thanks for all the well wishes, too, you know, on social media and stuff like that. I feel not 100% yet, but I feel much better than I did over the weekend. So be careful, everybody. Wash your hands and take your vitamins. All right, let's take a break here, and then we'll come back with the movie reviews.
Money.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago on this Monday morning. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Monday morning movie reviews are coming up as well. We're also going to talk about some of the best opening scenes in movies. Pulp Fiction opened this week in 1994, if you can believe that, how long ago that was. We're going to talk about some weird sports superstitions and more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. Every Monday morning, Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me to talk about the Monday morning movie reviews. This week, they're going to be doing all the heavy lifting because I didn't leave my apartment for 4 days because I was sick. So these guys are going to be handling all the movie reviews. So let's bring Eric in. Eric, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's say hello to Steve. Steve?
Hello. I'm here.
All right. Good. Everybody's here. All right. So the Monday morning movie reviews, you guys are going to handle it all because I have I was sick.
You had a bad weekend.
Oh.
I would say you had a good weekend this particular weekend.
I understand. Wow, man. I just knocked me on my butt. It was terrible. So, anyway, I'm still not 100%, but I'm better than I was. I can tell you that. Anyway, let's get to some of these movies here. Steve, what about The Woman Who Loves Giraffes?
Yeah, this is a little something that's at the Gene Siskel Film Center right now. Several years before Jane Goodall went into the jungle to study primates, a 23-year-old Canadian woman named Anne Innes Dagg traveled alone to South Africa to begin what would become her lifelong study of giraffes in their natural environment, a passion that began with her as a child and led her down a path that included a lot of roadblocks, most of them put up by men, ultimately made her the world's foremost authority on giraffes. And this documentary by Allison Reed is compelling and uplifting, and it takes us through her life and her struggles and her triumphs that she faced on this road to becoming a successful researcher and author. She penned a book that is still considered to be basically the Bible for giraffe researchers. She was a teacher, wife, mother, and ultimately a feminist icon. The number of very basic things that were denied her in her efforts to return to Africa in the decades since her initial visit, simply because of her gender, is sort of an embarrassment to higher education and scientific study. She was repeatedly denied tenure at a university she was teaching at, even though she had dozens of published papers and earned a doctorate and had a book. It wasn't until more recent years, as interest in giraffes has expanded because their numbers are dwindling, that she was pulled back in by a younger generation of researchers that kind of worship her writings. They invited her to speak at conferences and eventually got her back to South Africa, where she sort of picked up where she left off and discovered that a lot of her early findings were not correct. And she did something that almost never happens in the scientific community. She went back and fixed her original text because they were some mistakes, and I guess that doesn't happen very often. There's a tremendous amount of really great archival footage, most of which that Dagg shot herself in 1956, but more revealing are these sort of photographs and letters from her first visit. The letters are actually read by actress and fellow Canadian Tatiana Maslany, and most of those letters are to her soon-to-be husband at the time. It's sort of just really heartwarming to watch her back with these giraffes, and it's genuinely moving, long overdue. She revisits locations where she worked 60 years ago, and her enthusiasm hasn't waned a bit. The film is an inspiration, but it also doesn't spare those who deserve criticism for their limited ideas about women in the field and in the classroom. It has a strong message about conservation, too, obviously, and obviously more footage of these strange and majestic creatures than you're ever going to see in one place. So I highly recommend it. And like I said, it's playing through the week at the Gene Siskel Film Center.
Okay. That's The Woman Who Loves Giraffes. All right, cool. All right, Eric, let's talk about El Camino, a Breaking Bad story.
Yes. how this is actually a follow-up now to the Breaking Bad, the conclusion of the Breaking Bad series, basically an epilogue that Vince Gilligan, the creator of the show, wrote and directed, and is playing exclusively on Netflix currently. And it follows what happens when, sorry for people who have not binged Breaking Bad up to this point, but so there'll be a little bit of spoilers here, but the film pretty much begins where the finale ended, where Jesse Pinkman, played by Aaron Paul, has escaped his captors and is on the run, while pretty much everyone else that he's associated with, oh, nearly everyone, is dead. So as he's on the run, trying to escape, not just, you know, anyone who might be left from the gang that captured him, as well as the authorities, we basically get sort of a retread, sort of revisiting, not just, you know, some of the surviving members of the cast, but also, going back in time and sort of filling in blanks throughout the show, notably, his time in captivity. The first hour of the film is sort of, filled with, a lot of, I mean, the whole movie is filled with a lot of flashbacks and extended ones. You know, a lot of time spent with Jesse Plemons' really sort of sociopathic, psychopathic character that was one of his captives. And, you know, sort of getting a sense of what Pinkman went through. And because this is a story that is, you know, you mentioned Pulp Fiction earlier, is also, you know, also very much about the redemption of this character. You know, Jesse Pinkman and Walter White, some might say, were, you know, unworthy of redemption, and you know, sort of picking up where Pinkman left off and thinking about everything that he was associated with during this entire series, you might think that he might not exactly be a candidate for our sympathies, but he was. He grew into that over time. And this, you know, this last sort of period in his life where he was captured, we really get that fleshed out here in this movie, and we really kind of get the sense that he's kind of done his time, basically. He's sort of, you know, created this penance by, you know, all these horrible deeds that he'd done are basically sort of purged out of him through this captivity, and it builds very much like the film itself kind of feels like bonus episodes of the show. Just a lot of stuff, individual situations, particularly some of the flashbacks, feel like standalone episodes that we might have missed during the six-season run of the show. But it really does build very well. You know, I think the first hour kind of feels a little bit more episodic, but as this film sort of reveals Jesse's journey and leading up to some very tense stuff that happens in the second half of this movie, we really do get sort of a really nice bit of fan service that Vince Gilligan has given us. Aaron Paul is really terrific in this movie, and we get to revisit some of the characters that we love, some that didn't make it to the end of the series. Some of them reappear, many of them reappear in cameos, including the late, great Robert Forster, who has a very key role in this film, and the couple scenes that he has in this movie is just a heartbreak unto itself, just seeing just what kind of character actor he was, how he could command scenes in just a couple minutes and say so much through silences as well. So I'm you know, El Camino is definitely, you have to have seen the series to really have an appreciation of this movie. So don't really go into it thinking otherwise. It's not so much a standalone movie as it is a continuation of the series, and I think fans will mostly be very pleased with it.
Okay, and that's playing on Netflix, right?
Yes.
All right, El Camino, Breaking Bad movie. I have not caught up on Breaking Bad, so I'm going to have to, I think, wait on this one before I check it out. But I really always liked Aaron Paul. I think he's a terrific actor. So, all right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress and Steve Procopio are here, and we're reviewing the new movies on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. We'll do box office as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text, and more movie reviews right after this.
whispers of light in the skies over.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio in downtown Chicago here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. We're going to talk about box office as well and some weird sports superstitions. And we look back in history. 1994, Pulp Fiction opened. We're going to talk about that and some of the best opening scenes in movies. All of that and more, 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And it is the Monday Morning Movie Reviews with Eric and Steve. Let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Hey, Steve, let's talk first. You know, you mentioned, Eric just mentioned Robert Forster. And the Music Box of Horrors is happening, and you guys are actually going to show Alligator, and that was already scheduled, right?
Yeah, that's next weekend. It starts Saturday, October 19th at noon, and it's just a 24-hour. We do it every year, 24 hours of just nothing but, like, the most wonderful face-melting horror things. A few familiar titles, but a lot of also really rare things that don't get screened very often. And it just so happened we had Alligator lined up. Now, you have to be a diehard to see it because it's at 3:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
It's written by John Sayles, so there's actual like greatness involved other than just, and it's a rare lead performance from Robert Forster. So I hope people, I mean, I know the thing's going to sells out every year, but I have a feeling people are going to stay awake for that one. And I think it's going to be just a really wonderful way to celebrate. And we've also, it's weird because, the last film we're playing is the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which was meant to just be like a fun way to cap everything off, but in sort of a tribute to Luke Perry, who's one of the leads in that, but then also after we booked it, Rutger Hauer died, who's also in that film, so it is. There's a lot of recently deceased people represented this year. That's fine. That's how we're glad we can accidentally be this timely. But I'm really looking forward to the lineup this year for sure.
Well, what are some of the other ones? What are you guys showing?
We've got we're opening with we usually open with a silent film. This year it's The Man Who Laughs, which I'm pretty sure we booked this before we knew Joker was playing in 70 at the Music Box, but it is, if you've ever seen the character in that film, you know that it is clearly the visual reference point for Joker from the comic books.
Yeah.
And we have two guests this year. We have a filmmaker named John Hancock, who made a great film called Let's Scare Jessica to Death. We're playing that fairly early. It's like the third film of the day at 3:45. And then later on Saturday, we're playing Dog Soldiers, which is the first feature from Neil Marshall, and he's coming in as well. Neil Marshall is just, I think, one of the real greats of the horror genre, and forgetting for a minute that he made this most recent Hellboy. But yeah, I mean, I just think his work, I've met him a few times before, I think he's great, and I'm really looking forward to people seeing that on the big screen, because I'm guessing, I don't think it really played that widely in Chicago. Toward the end, we're playing like Halloween 2 and The Fly 2 and Demons 2, so we've got like Bava represented. It's a cool, and we've even got like, and most, almost everything is screening in 35 millimeter. I think we have one 16 millimeter. I think Let's Scare Jessica to Death is actually 16 millimeter. We have one movie called Retribution that I've never seen before that is actually the director's personal print because we couldn't find any other. So yeah, it's just like this wonderful exercise of going through the familiar and the weirdly unfamiliar.
Mm. All right,
and well, there's cool. Like tons of vendors and food trucks stop by at all hours, and so yeah, it just becomes like a big party by the end.
There you go. Music Box of Horrors. I've made it through a few a few weekends at the Music Box as part of that. So that sounds like a great thing. And to see to see Alligator on the big screen again, man. You know, I love that movie. That movie is just fantastic. And got a great sense of humor. Lewis Teague directed it, who would go on to direct Cujo.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's good stuff. So get your Music Box of Horrors, and you can check out the Music Box website for more information and complete schedule and all that good stuff. All right, cool. Okay, Steve, tell us about Pain and Glory.
Oh, okay. This is
this is Almodovar, right?
Yes, yes. No, this is a journey of an aging filmmaker coming to terms with his legacy and his history of relationships and even his body that is sort of breaking down during the course of the film, in a career that spans back to the late 1970s. Spain's Pedro Almodovar has delivered dozens of films that sort of add up to a really impressive portfolio, films that tell very bold stories in very bold ways using colorful production design and live music and stories about strong women and sexuality and seriously, even just storyline issues that if any American director, I don't think any American director would ever tackle so regularly. But Pain and Glory is something much more introspective than I'm used to even from him, and he's made movies about his mother before. So this filmmaker in this story, Almodovar, I should say, takes his own life and career as an inspiration for a character named Salvador Malo, who's an aging auteur played by Antonio Banderas, who we used to work with pretty regularly and hasn't worked with in quite a while. He's struggling with a bunch of health issues, just as interest in his first film happens around the anniversary of its release, and he's sort of reminded of the film's impact when it first hit screens. And he finds himself getting very nostalgic about many things in his life, including the actor that starred in that film, with whom he did not get along with very well at the time and has been estranged with ever since. But it also makes him think about his own childhood and growing up in poverty as an only child. And there is some discussion about whether, you know, there has been some discussion since the film premiered about whether the actor in the film, the character of the actor, is actually supposed to be Banderas, because it's clear that Banderas is playing Almodovar. So, yeah, I mean, it's all very meta and very cool. Honestly, this is maybe the best thing I've ever seen Antonio Banderas do, and I tend to like his performances in most things. And he's sort of looking back at his life and what it has added up to this point. He's had his back injuries that required surgery, and the commitment to like the physical demands of this role are just as incredible as the emotional demands. Every movement seems considered and deliberate, and it's meant to look very painful. And he just really, really shines and allows us some glimpses of emotional anguish that he navigates on top of the physical torment. So he gets together with this actor, and they discuss the possibility of going to this Q&A screening, and they fight, but they also do really hard drugs. And it turns out that these hard drugs, which the director doesn't usually use, are actually really helping with the pain. So that kind of adds to everything going on in this film. There's also another character who shows up late in the film named Federico, who turns out to have been the director's, the person he thinks he first ever really truly loved, like years and years ago. And he just happens to be in the same town as him, and they reunite briefly and just for a night to talk and catch up. And it's a really poignant scene. It almost feels like a separate movie, but it's actually really beautiful and fits in really nicely. Some of the best stuff involves these flashbacks into Salvador's childhood and his doting mother, who's played by Penelope Cruz, who is also someone that Almodovar has worked with many times before. We learn about their move to this coastal city where his father found the family a small home, which is basically a glorified cave. There's discussion of sending this kid to a seminary school. There's an encounter with a local teenager that this little boy has that he's tutoring to learn
okay,
to
Steve,
read.
Steve, hang on for a second.
Sure.
We got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more about Pain and Glory, which is Almodovar's new movie, and we'll get more thoughts on that right after we break here on 720 WGN. back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And, yeah. And we are also going to be talking about weird sports superstitions and some of the best opening scenes in movies and all kinds of really cool stuff. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. 312-981-7200. It's also Monday morning, and that means Monday morning movie reviews. And we're in the middle of those right now. Steve and Eric join me every Monday morning to review the movies. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, Steve, you were continuing about Pain and Glory.
Yeah, just to wrap it up, like I said, these flashbacks to this when this director was a little boy, and he has one very important one that has to do with him sort of becoming aware of where his physical attractions lie. It just in general, nostalgia can very easily, and especially in film, easily warp into sort of self-indulgence and feel like you're falling into a rut. But in Pain and Glory, Almodovar avoids this trap very easily and instead delivers a story of reflection and the passage of time. As anyone with decades behind them, and certainly as an artist, can appreciate, this is a stunning piece of filmmaking, and like I said, Banderas, I don't think has ever been better, and his performance here is one I could watch over and over again. And so it not only makes this one of Almodovar's best films, but I think one of the year's best films.
Okay. All right. It's playing in three theaters. It's at the River East. It's at the Landmark Century and at in Evanston, the Century 12 in Evanston.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it's playing. Okay. Pain and Glory. All right. Eric, why don't you tell us about Dolomite Is My Name?
Okay. We talked about this briefly from the Toronto Film Festival, so I'll recap this for the new audience. But this is the story of Rudy Ray Moore. People who are not familiar with Rudy Ray Moore, he was a struggling comedian back in the 1970s. Did a lot of stage warm-ups for acts and nightclubs and things like that, and really wanted to make it bigger. And he started doing that by coming across these local folk tales told through limericks, basically, and began telling these stories, live through a character he created called Dolomite. And this would actually lead to him creating will be called party albums, these dirty albums, that he was selling on the streets, basically, that became big hits within, the African American community. And then he wanted to take it a step further, and develop a movie, around the Dolomite character. Rudy Ray Moore in the movie is played by Eddie Murphy, this is quite the return of Eddie Murphy. This is the Eddie Murphy that we really grew to love back in the 1980s. This is sort of the perfect fit between actor and a character, in this case a real-life character. The movie was directed by Craig Brewer. It was written by Larry Kazanowski and Scott Alexander, who basically created a niche in film of creating these crazy, true life biopics, mostly centered around filmmakers, people like Ed Wood, we had People vs. Larry Flint, The Disaster Artist, amongst others, People vs. O.J. Simpson miniseries, and they wrote this one as well, and this one fits right into that wheelhouse, and as the characters so often say throughout the film, basically give the audience what they want, and anyone coming into this movie who even has even just an inkling of who Rudy Ray Moore was are going to get exactly what they want out of this film. This is a really funny, very sweet film with a tremendous cast, not just Eddie Murphy, Wesley Snipes, just killing it in this film. It's a great return for him. Craig Robinson's in it, and a whole bunch of Keegan Michael Key plays the serious playwright who ends up writing the Dolomite film. And most of what they actually film in the movie is mostly the Human Tornado. It's mostly scenes from that movie that we see, even though it's referred to as Dolomite. But this is probably like one of the sweetest films you will ever see, with the number of times they actually say a 12-letter swear word as often as they do it throughout the movie. This movie, it's in theaters now. It'll be there for a couple weeks, and then it will be making its debut on Netflix, which, any chance you can get to see this movie with an audience would be, quite a thing. But if you have to wait for a couple weeks for Netflix, it is absolutely worth your time. It is a lot of fun.
Okay. All right. What did you think, Steve?
I think this is great. And Eric's right. See it in a theater, but good luck finding it in a theater, at least around Chicago. Because there are things about this film that, like, demand just show you how beautifully made it is, from the production design to the costumes by Ruthie Carter, who just won an Oscar for doing costumes for Black Panther. The cinematography is gorgeous. He just sort of makes every scene pop with these really warm colors. It would be a shame if you didn't at least try to make the effort to see this film on the big screen. It doesn't hit Netflix for a couple of weeks, but I got to say, Eric's right. There are definitely points, especially in the second half, and we should make it clear, this is not just about the making of this film. This is about this guy's career. It's not a life story, but it's like basically from when he first hit it big as a comedian to like every sort of the very natural progression, it feels like, into making this film. But it does feel, parts of it do feel, once we get to the making of it, does feel a lot like The Disaster Artist, and that's not a criticism at all. There are just some really hilarious behind the scenes exploits. It's honestly, you almost watch Eddie Murphy and you go, why hasn't he done, this feels like something that should have happened 20 years ago. And maybe it took meeting someone like Craig Brewer, who has sort of a history of making these very blaxploitation-ish films like Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan, and he's also doing the Coming to America sequel with Eddie Murphy. So maybe he needed to meet that guy to really feel comfortable making this movie. But it's like a return to his R-rated roots, and make no mistake, this is about as R-rated as you can get right now. But I also love the idea that this is not just like a making fun of the making of this film and how much of an amateur production it was. This is about like a guy who was driven, and he like had a complete, well-conceived vision for what he wanted to create, and more importantly, who he wanted to create it for. He felt like his community was being underserved by Hollywood, and he wanted to make something that kind of checked all the boxes for them. And it was a risk that could have broken him financially and spiritually, but like anyone who knows their film history knows that's not what happened. And this ended up making something that audiences of every conceivable color connected with and still celebrate. So I think this movie's terrific, and I hope people actually check it out in the theaters.
I can't wait to see it, because I mean, I love Dolomite. And Rudy Ray Moore, man, is the man. And this is like, that's like the perfect storm for Eddie Murphy to play this role. You know what I mean? I can't think of anybody else who should play this part but him.
I think this is actually the best thing he's done since Bowfinger. Which then this movie shares a lot in common with that movie. I mean, that would actually make a perfect double feature.
Yeah. God, I haven't seen Bowfinger in a long time. I love that movie.
Yeah.
And we should also call out, and of course I wrote it down and now I can't find it, the actress who plays Lady Reed, whose name is Divine Joy Randolph, because she steals like every scene. And not just that, and she's not trying to, she's just got like a beautiful singing voice, and she ended up becoming like his sidekick on the road when he was doing stand up and man, but just he just has a partnership with her that I loved. Like, I love the sensibility of that and how he kind of checked himself with her and she sort of talked to him about her insecurities. It's a great, great role. And I guess she's either won a Tony or had nominated for a Tony recently, I've never seen her. I've never seen her in anything before. So I was like, oh, I need to see more with her.
Got it. All right.
Yeah, so she's really good.
Dolomite is my name. All right, you guys hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric, Steve, we're going to hang on. We're going to come back, and we got more movies to review right here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here on WGN on a Monday morning. And the Monday morning movie reviews are continuing, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday. And lots of stuff happening here on the show. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And we've got Eric and Steve here to review the movies. Let's welcome Eric back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Steve, why don't you tell us about Gemini Man?
Oh, okay. So the latest from director Ang Lee is Gemini Man. And it actually is based on a screenplay that's been bouncing around Hollywood for more than 20 years. But apparently it wasn't until now that the special effects technology that would basically be necessary to make this film were available. To put things into context, I think one iteration of this movie was going to star Clint Eastwood. And the screenplay, the current screenplay, combines work from David Benioff from Game of Thrones, one of the creators there, Billy Ray, who I know you know, Nick, yeah. and Darren Lemke. Gemini Man stars Will Smith as Henry Brogan, an assassin for hire, usually by the government, who is ready to retire. But then he finds out that the person that he killed on his final job was a scientist who, as far as he could tell, posed no threat to the free world or national security. And he gets curious and attempts to find out why this guy was targeted and why he needed to die and who ordered the hit. And as his investigation progresses, he himself becomes a target of someone named Clay Varys, who's played by Clive Owen, a man whose organization seems to believe only in weaponizing all technology. As a result, some of Varys's projects, both the scientist and now Henry have to be taken out. So Henry becomes a man on the run, and he's assisted by an agent named Danny, played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who was hired at first to survey Henry's activity during his retirement passively, and now she's saving him from a large number of assassins who aren't quite as good as Henry, except for one, whose name is Junior, and just happens to be, and I don't think this is a spoiler because it's been in like every trailer, he's a clone of Henry who's about half his age and has been trained practically from birth to be this perfect killing machine. Will Smith plays both roles, and from what I understand, the younger version is in fact a full CG face replacement and not like a de-aging, the current version of Will Smith, like is popular with some other movies right now. The results are fairly astonishing just from a special effects perspective. Junior doesn't understand that he's a clone. The younger Henry indeed looks like a slightly bulkier Fresh Prince, but without the facial hair. And while you may actually get distracted by the overall impact of two Will Smiths frequently in the same shot and fighting each other, the effects are mostly seamless. I did notice some weird issues sort of coloring outside the lines in moments where they're in broad daylight, but there are some individual set pieces, action set pieces that are strong, including an early motorcycle chase between the two Smiths, but when the two guys actually start conversing, the wind is kind of yanked right out of the whole thing. And even in the moral discussions about the ethics of cloning, they seem obligatory and don't really set the world on fire with any deep thought. Smith does a credible job of playing this dual role. The older guy is sort of even-tempered and more cerebral, and then the younger guy is following orders and training, and but he's still sort of a youthful hothead and lets his emotions get the best of him. Winstead is sporadically allowed to contribute in both the thinking and the fighting portions of the plot. Clive Owen kind of holds up in his lair for most of the film, wringing his hands and scheming like villains do, so he doesn't really contribute that much. Gemini Man is basically a huge misstep for both Smith and Lee, and even if the special effects turned out exactly as planned, as far as I know they did, that doesn't really save the movie from coming up short and feeling way too conventional. Smith is sort of built of natural charisma and charm, but the days of that being enough to sustain a two-hour film are long behind him. I wouldn't call the film a complete wash, but it is definitely a flawed piece of work, so I am not recommending it.
All right, Eric, what did you think?
I'll go a step further. I don't think Ang Lee has made a worse film than this. I think that this movie is beyond a wash, because seemingly the only thing this movie has going for it is its ability to show off the latest version of this technology, which, frankly, is we've been seeing for the better part of 12, 13 years now. Yes, it was certainly sloppy and distracting at first, but it has been getting noticeably better. Marvel has certainly, taken advances in it. And, you know, of all the people that I want to see, you know, two of in a movie, one of the last people on that list is actually Will Smith, who does something remarkable in this movie. He gives two bad performances. Because the thing is that Will Smith, it just seems incapable when he's doing a movie like this of being anybody but Will Smith. I don't, you know, whatever his name is, Henry Brogan or whatever, I'm not seeing Henry Brogan. I'm seeing Will Smith play Will Smith, do Will Smith stuff throughout the entire movie, and then when he becomes young Will Smith, he's just more sort of a more whimpering, you know, younger version of that Will Smith, sort of Will Smith before he was cool, basically. Yes, the motorcycle chase that Steve referenced is a highlight in the film, and it's, I would say it's the only highlight in the film. Ang Lee, who has, certainly done some really terrific action work in his time, Crouching Tiger for certain. I'd even go so far and put Hulk in that category as well. But beyond that motorcycle chase, you would think that for everyone that's involved with this thing, that there's got to be, something to attract Lee other than just the tech. Like Steve said, there's very little probing discussion about the dangers of cloning. I think you could take any movie that's ever cloned anything, including parts of the Clonus Horror and Michael Bay's The Island, and you could find something of greater value in that discussion. What this film is eventually leading to, the action sequences are absolutely boring. Clive Owen, who is usually incapable of being this boring, I couldn't believe that he's the villain that we're all supposed to be, on edge about. Mary Elizabeth Winstead is wasted in the film. This movie is just, for as advanced as the tech is in this film, it's astounding just how generic everything surrounding it is in this movie. For 2 hours, just watching two bad Will Smith performances and a film that just seems incapable of going beyond saying, hey, look at this technology that we've perfected now, we spent $138 million on, and to give us nothing beyond that, other than a speech at the end and a late inning twist. That's really no twist whatsoever. The entire enterprise is a complete and utter waste and failure.
Wow. Wow. All right. This thing has been kicking around for 20 years.
More.
Jeez.
Yeah. But in various, you know, different writers, different actors, different directors. But yeah.
Right.
And we should mention in terms of tech that there's also, this is also shot in like this high frame rate thing, which I don't think I've seen it since The Hobbit, really. But this, the way they screened it for us wasn't in 3D or in this high frame rate. I don't know if it's playing anywhere around here like this. But again, it's the same thing we just said. Like, if you can't get the movie right, how it looks isn't really the most important thing.
Right.
So, but yeah, I mean, if you can find it, you know, give yourself something to like distract yourself with a high frame rate if you can find it. But yeah, apparently the 3D is pretty impressive, but who the hell knows?
Yeah.
I turned the motion smoothing off at home, and I remember that Hobbit screening, which I thought was just the most disastrous, distracting thing I could possibly imagine. So I went out of my way to make sure I didn't see it in that frame rate, frankly.
Yeah. It is. We just found out that it is playing at the River East in that capacity.
Oh, okay.
All right. You guys, hang on. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yes.
Eric and Steve are going to hang on, and we've got another movie to review, and then we'll talk about the box office as well as right here on 720 WGN.
Silent movie evening, shooting flickers of light in the skies over.
Right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6, as it is every weekday morning. I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. We got best opening scenes in movies we're going to talk about. We're also going to talk about some of the weirdest sports superstitions, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday morning, and it's a jokey time. Right now, we're wrapping up the things here with Eric Childress and Steve Procopi reviewing the new movies, and then we'll do the box office as well. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, Eric, tell us about the Addams Family.
Okay, well, this is the first time we've gotten Charles Addams' famous family back on the big screen since 1993's Addams Family Values. But this time we're getting it in animated form. You know, Charles Addams, you know, it was originally a comic strip, and now we have a full-blown animated film. With some really big names behind the voice work, Oscar Isaac as Gomez and Charlize Theron as Morticia, and as the movie begins, we meet the two of them on their wedding night, and things don't go right when basically the townsfolk drive them away, and they decide to settle in New Jersey. And many years later, we meet them again as their family has sprung forth, and we have Wednesday and Pugsley and all the people that we've come to know from this family, and we pick up exactly where they are in the current state of their living quarters. Basically, as far as the plot goes, Wednesday is interested in, or is set up to go to junior high, which is far more normal than her current living domains. We see how she, you know, attempts to shake things up there. Pugsley is on the verge of doing a rite of passage at home, and he is preparing for that with Gomez. But also lurking about in the community is a reality TV show host, voiced by Allison Janney, named Margot Needler, who is basically, you know, a fixer-upper. She, you know, she goes, comes into your house, and, you know, reinvents everything, remodels everything, gives you basically the perfect home. But she also has, you know, sort of nefarious plots, exactly what she wants to do with the community to sort of make it her sort of perfect, ideal community, which seems like a really interesting thing to do in this day and age, except this movie doesn't seem to want to go beyond the sort of the really basic stuff to sort of draw in the family audience. You know, the Paramount's live action versions with Raul Julia and Angelica Houston and Christina Ricci, you know, were PG-13 affairs, and they delved a little bit further into the macabre stuff. I thought for the first movie, kind of had that, hey, we're going to take this TV property and we're going to put it on the big screen, and isn't it going to be great? And it was just kind of okay. But then once they got the sort of introductions out of the way, they were able to really deliver something of really great value, no pun intended, with Adam's Family Values, which I still think is the high watermark of any of this, and I include the TV show as part of that. This one, it has an occasional chuckle here and there. I like the idea of the Allison Janney character, but I didn't feel that that went far enough. Wednesday being introduced into the high school and to take on sort of the mean girls in school never really goes anywhere. Her friendship with the daughter of the TV host also just kind of goes for the very basic, you know, she's going to turn her into a goth girl just like her. That doesn't really go very far. And it just seems very, the whole enterprise just seemed incredibly basic. And other than the New Jersey gag at the very beginning, there's very little sort of guffawing on my part. It was just not that funny. It was a real disappointment because I think that both Isaac and Theron are doing some really good voice work. Chloe Grace Moretz is playing Wednesday. She's doing good voice work, but doesn't get much to do with the character as much as Christina Ricci did. I really did not like Nick Kroll's voice work as Uncle Fester. Every time he shows up, it just seems like he's just got something in his mouth the entire time, and he just seems a bit like drooling off screen. It was just really off-putting every time he spoke, and so that character ended up being twice as annoying as usual. I didn't quite see the value in doing this if you were just going to do it in such a simplistic, family-oriented way.
Okay. All right, Steve, what do you think?
I thought it was very funny. I mean, it's I had to actually look when I got home from seeing this to see what the rating was, because I thought some of the jokes were like very dark and borderline inappropriate, and I mean that in the best way. That's how they should be. These people aren't just, this family isn't just like playing spook house. They're like genuine death mongers, and I love that aspect of it. Anytime they went somewhere I was not expecting, I was very happy. The first thing I noticed about the film was that, and that made me very happy, was that the characters looked almost exactly like that original comic strip version. I thought it, you know, I just like that idea that we're going back to the way they should be. And the one thing you realize almost immediately is that this is a story about like this family with this husband and wife that truly love each other. They care about each other's feelings, even if those feelings involve misery. And that's kind of the point. They support each other's lifestyles unconditionally. There's no judgment, and their marriage is stronger and better for it. And I was actually really, I think some of my favorite stuff was the stuff between Wednesday and this friend of hers, Parker, who actually is voiced by Elsie Fisher from Eighth Grade, and the way that their lifestyles kind of rub off on each other, like whereas this girl Parker does become something of a goth girl, but then also Wednesday starts adding splashes of color to her usually black and white wardrobe, and it just freaks out her parents, and they are having their ideas about being embracive of their daughter's choices tested by these pink outfits that she adds. I mean, you know, much like the TV show, the film, you know, it sort of loves to show that contrast between the Addams Family and the North, quote-unquote, normal people. I don't know if that stuff works as well. I wasn't even that big a fan of what Allison Janney was doing here. I was much more involved in the more personal stories. But, like, there are some really nice voice cameos from Catherine O'Hara and Martin Short as Morticia's dead but very communicative parents. And Bette Midler plays Gomez's mother from the old country.
And we should mention that the directors of this, Greg Tiernan, who did Sausage Party, and Conrad Vernon, who did Shrek 2 and Monsters vs. Aliens, I think they just have like a good sensibility about the tone this thing needs to hit, and especially in the humor, because there are messages about inclusion and acceptance, and this family are like kind of legendary outcasts, and so they're relevant as well as entertaining, and I think kids are going to dig it. The kids in the audience I saw it with seem to dig it, but I also think it's safe for adults to go and see on their own. So, I dug it. I dug most of it, yeah.
I will say this. My parents went to see it over the weekend. They enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So, but I got to say, you mentioned Addams Family Values, Eric. I love that movie.
Yeah, it's great.
It is so funny. And Christina Ricci, when she smiles, you know this? You know the scene?
Oh, yeah.
One of the great, I don't even know what to say. Paul Rudnick wrote that, man.
Every punchline that Raul Julia has in that movie, I remember I laughed so hard at that trailer that I thought all the best jokes were in that trailer, and they weren't.
No, it's a funny movie. It really is. It's a terrific movie. Okay. All right. So what do we got next week?
We got Zombieland, Maleficent.
Right? Zombieland.
Zombieland 2 and Maleficent 2.
Okay.
Mistress of Evil.
Right.
And Parasite finally opens in Chicago.
Oh, yes.
Which just
opens.
Broke a record this weekend. So
did it.
Yeah.
Yeah, people are loving that movie, man.
There yeah. Yep.
Okay.
It's phenomenal.
All right, Steve, thanks, man.
All right, sure.
And Eric, you hang out, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric's going to hang on, and we're going to come back and talk box office here on 720 WGN right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude every weekday morning, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. And Monday morning, that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey-jokey time. And we just finished the Monday morning movie reviews, and now Eric's going to hang out with us, and we're going to talk box office. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
Okay, so Joker, number one again. Did we think that was going to happen?
I thought it was going to happen. I did not think it was going to make as much as it did.
Yeah.
This is, I mean, it goes without saying that this is quite a incredible drop for this movie that opened to $96 million last week and only dropped just under 43% this week. That's only been done for films that have grossed over $80 million in their opening weekend. This is only the 10th time that a film has dropped less than 44%.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. $192 million total.
Yeah. It seems inevitable that it's going to become the highest grossing film ever released in October, surpassing Gravity, as disappointing as that is. It seems destined like it is going to gross over $300 million.
That's amazing. Really is crazy. All right, number two, The Addams Family with $30 million. Those are good numbers.
Very, very good numbers. This one actually surprised me. I didn't know that there was going to be such an appetite for an Addams Family movie. I thought that this was going to be more in the sort of the Goosebumps range, because I had a feeling. I thought that, you know, the Hotel Transylvania movies exist. So which have been incredible hits, and I guess in lieu of not having a fourth one this year, people went to go see that.
Yeah, I guess it's the same. It's target audience. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Yeah. Wow, Gemini Man. How poorly are Will Smith's movies doing now?
They're not good. Yeah. You know, and people might want to, you know, might point to like Aladdin and Suicide Squad, but those films have built-in audiences.
Yeah.
People didn't go to those movies because of Will Smith. And Will Smith hasn't really had sort of a standalone Will Smith vehicle hit since Hancock in 2008.
Jeez.
You know, you think about, like, Focus and Concussion and some of these other movies that he's done, which, granted, are not all, you know, big, you know, tentpole-type movies.
Yeah.
But the whole point was that you could put Will Smith in those movies and people would show up.
Yeah.
That's clearly not the case. And I think more, you know, maybe we're discovering that it was the subject matter, the sci-fi subject matter that he was, you know, engaged in all these years that was the draw and not so much him.
Yeah. All right. Abominable, 6.1 million up to 48 million total.
Yeah, pretty much on his path to do somewhere in the 60 to 65 million range. Not particularly great. This one is still looking like a loser for Universal. It's only made another 60 million overseas as well, so it's just over like 100 some million worldwide.
Mm. Wait, Downton Abbey in the top five. Man, it's just killing it. 82,
yeah,
it's up to
yeah.
82 million.
And on the week that Ang Lee's Gemini Man absolutely fails, it's double trouble for him because now this movie, within the next few days, is going to become Focus Features' all-time domestic grosser, besting Brokeback Mountain.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Number six, Hustler, still doing good business.
Also killing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one's going to pass 100 million this week.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Number seven is Judy. 3.2 million, 14.9 total. Is that going to stick around? I mean, because there's going to be Oscar buzz, obviously, for.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be. You'll be seeing it, pad out for the rest of the year, but certainly over the next couple of weeks, its core audience is clearly still coming out to see it. It always seemed it was on its pace to do somewhere around 20 to 25 million overall, and that seems to be exactly where it's headed right now. Roadside's done a pretty good job expanding the film. It's still only in about 1,600 theaters compared to others. But again, the audience is coming out for it, and you know that's even a $25 million hit for Judy is going to go a long way in mounting the Zellweger campaign.
Yeah. Okay. It Chapter Two coming in at number eight. How's that doing compared to the first one?
It's a hit. It's a hit for Warner Brothers. It didn't do nearly as well as the first film did. But this is a series. You combine them together, it's a $1 billion series. So it did exactly what Warner Brothers wanted it to do. It's over $200 million. It's one of the most successful horror films of all time, highest grossing at least.
Okay. Number nine, Jexy.
Yeah, first mention of Jexy tonight.
Yeah, $3 million. it's like a vulgar version of Her, right?
Right. Yeah, it's Her, but from the writers of The Hangover and Bad Moms.
Yeah. Okay.
That says it all. 3.1 million.
Yeah, okay. And then number 10 is Ad Astra, 1.9 million, 47 million total. That's not good.
No, $120 million worldwide. This is a pretty hefty. I mean, it's not Gemini Man numbers, but so at least seems Gemini Man will probably do worse budget wise than this film does. But this film's barely going to crack $50 million domestic. Not nearly what the Fox and James Gray were hoping for.
Wow. Okay. Wow. All right. Well, next week I guess Maleficent will be number one.
Joker is doing so well, and I would if you were to press me on it, I would say Maleficent will come in. I don't think it's going to do nearly as well as the first movie did. I don't even think Zombieland is going to do as well as the first film did. I'm kind of curious to see where that's going to come in next week too. That could come in third place. Joker could settle into second place,
yeah.
And Zombieland could come in third. I don't know how Neon is going to expand Parasite next week. It's expanding further, but still going to be in pretty limited release. But in only three theaters this weekend, it grossed $376,000.
Wow.
Yeah, that is it's the best per theater average since La La Land in 2016. It's the 18th best PTA of all time. Of movies that open in just three theaters, it's got the third best per theater average of all time behind Diving Bell and the Butterfly and Dreamgirls.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's impressive.
It is, very
that's impressive.
Much so.
I'm really looking forward to Zombieland.
I am too.
I can't wait to see it.
I'm hopeful.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you got the same cast, you got the same writers, you got the same director.
Yeah.
The trailers are making me laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And the Zoe Deutsch is already cracking me up. just in the trailer. She looks hilarious. Yeah. She looks like she's going to be hilarious. I love it when Emma Stone goes, oh, my God, she's adorable.
Yeah, I mean, Ruben Fleischer has not exactly done anything I've liked since Zombieland. So hopefully he's going back to this well. And, you know, these are characters that I really liked the first time. And I've seen the movie multiple times since then. So I'm just hoping that, you know, we didn't get too much of a good thing back then, and that there's still a little bit left in these people, because I really like them.
Yeah, me too. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And for those of us who are reviewing the movie, if there are surprise cameos in it, don't give them away.
Yeah. Because, well, one trailer's already done it.
Oh, they have?
The latest trailer has done a flashback cameo.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I remember when Zombieland came out, I couldn't believe it. I really seriously couldn't believe that critics gave away the fact that Bill Murray was in it.
Yeah.
I mean, I just what is wrong with you?
I think we kept it when we reviewed it on the show. I think we purposely danced around it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think even at the end of the year when we did like best cameo on our list, I don't think we even said it then.
Yeah, no.
I think we just said that cameo in Zombieland.
Right. That's what we did. I mean, because, you know, I mean, it's just such a great, it was just such a huge and hilarious surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the best cameos ever.
I think it might be the greatest cameo of all time.
It is right up there, man. It's definitely right up there. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, we'll see. Maybe is he going to come back again as a zombie in this one? Because, you know.
Well, that would be cool.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
Because he does get killed in the...
Yeah, not shot in the head.
No, exactly. So they do kill Bill Murray in the in the movie. So anyway, all right, I'm looking forward to that. And then the Disney, this Maleficent, was that a big hit?
Huge hit.
Yeah?
Huge hit. Yeah, 220-some million, maybe more than that, actually, and a huge worldwide hit as well. It seems weird that they're releasing it in October. They've been trying to get this thing made for a while. They've been, you know, dancing around Angelina's schedule and stuff, and so they finally got it out, and I think this is the only place they had to put it, I think, so.
Okay. All right, and then also for the smaller theaters, you got Jojo Rabbit, which is coming out on Friday, and I'm really looking forward to Robert Eggers' follow-up to The Witch, The Lighthouse.
Right.
So those are. It's been a pretty interesting week next week, just in terms of content alone, and then we'll see how much money these movies make. So
totally.
All right, Eric. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks a lot, man.
All right, man. Take care.
Okay. You
there
too.
You go, Eric Childress. Everybody, he writes a piece about the box office as well, and every Sunday night / Monday morning he releases that, and we always talk about the box office, and we'll do it again next week. All right, we're going to take a quick break here on 720 WGN. And we're going to talk about some of the Pulp Fiction came out in 1994, right around this time. And we're going to talk about the best opening scenes in movies as well. And we will also remember Robert Forrester, who passed away over the weekend. All right, quick break here, and then we'll come back with more on 720 WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Monday morning, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And there you go. Also, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. So stay tuned for that. So little Dick Dale there, because on this date, October 14th in the year 1994, Pulp Fiction opened in theaters. It's an awesome movie, as I think we all know. On October 14th, 1994, the writer-director Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, a crime drama featuring multiple storylines and a large ensemble cast, including John Travolta, Uma Thurman, Samuel Jackson, Bruce Willis, Harvey Keitel, opens in theaters, made for less than $10 million. Wow. I didn't realize the budget was that low. Made for less than $10 million, Pulp Fiction earned more than $100 million at the box office and was also a huge critical hit, winning the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival and earning 7 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture. Tarantino and Roger Avery shared the Oscar for Best Screenplay. Some critics have called Pulp Fiction, which spawned a slew of imitators, the most influential movie of all time. It contained such Tarantino trademarks as clever dialogue, graphic violence, and numerous pop culture references. The film is also credited with reviving the movie career of John Travolta, who, as the ponytailed hitman Vincent Vega, shares a memorable dance with his boss's wife, played by Uma Thurman, and famously discusses his partner, Jackson, on how, in France, McDonald's Quarter Pounder with Cheese is called a Royale with Cheese. They're all classic stuff. Tarantino was born on March 27, 1963 in Knoxville, Tennessee. He dropped out of high school, studied acting, and worked at a video rental store in Manhattan Beach, California, where he reportedly spent all day talking about movies. No. In the late 80s, he appeared as an Elvis impersonator on an episode of the TV sitcom The Golden Girls. Tarantino made his directorial debut with the 1992 indie film Reservoir Dogs about the events surrounding a bungled jewel heist. Written by Tarantino, the violent film featured characters with names such as Mr. Pink and Mr. Blonde, co-starred Keitel, Tim Roth, Steve Buscemi, Chris Penn, Michael Madsen, and Lawrence Tierney. Initially released in a small number of theaters, Reservoir Dogs garnered more attention and became a cult hit after Pulp Fiction turned Tarantino into a Hollywood darling. His third feature film, 1997's Jackie Brown, which starred Pam Grier and just the recently passed Robert Forrester, got nominated for it, for that movie. He's so good in it. Robert De Niro, Bridget Fonda, Samuel L. Jackson, and Michael Keaton, inspired by the Elmore Leonard novel Rum Punch. Jackie Brown was also an homage to the so-called blaxploitation films of the 70s, a number of which featured Greer. In addition to directing his own movies, Tarantino also penned the screenplay for 1993's True Romance, which was helmed by Tony Scott and co-starred Christian Slater, Patricia Arquette. He was also credited with the developing story and for director Oliver Stone's Natural Born Killers with Woody Harrelson and Juliette Lewis. Tarantino also continued acting, appeared in several of his own movies and co-starring opposite Keitel and George Clooney in 1996's From Dusk Till Dawn. Tarantino's fourth feature project as a director was Kill Bill, which was released as two films, Kill Bill Volume 1 in 2003 and Kill Bill Volume 2, in 2004. Both movies starred Uma Thurman as a violent revenge-seeking character named The Bride. Tarantino's other projects include 2007's Death Proof, 2009's Inglourious Basterds, 2012's Django Unchained, and 2015's The Hateful Eight, and this year's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So, a big day for a movie release. Now, again, What was the first Tarantino movie you saw?
First Tarantino movie I ever saw was Death Proof.
Right.
And it still ranks up as one of my favorites by him. I think it's ridiculously undervalued and underappreciated, despite the fact that I think it's one of the most flat-out fun movies he ever made.
Yeah.
But Pulp Fiction is my favorite Tarantino movie, probably my favorite movie of all time.
Well, Pulp Fiction is my favorite Tarantino movie, too. I think it's easily his best movie. And I know that's, you know, not an unpopular opinion,
not
you know,
at all.
For most people to go, yeah, Pulp Fiction is the best. But I know a lot of people who stand by. I know a lot of people who really back Jackie Brown.
There are some that say that is his best movie.
Yeah, I have friends who absolutely believe that. I think it's very underrated. I don't think it gets mentioned as much as a lot of his other movies do. Mm-hmm. I'm also a really big fan of The Hateful Eight. I love that movie. And I like his last one is one of his best. This Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is a great movie.
And very much in the same vein as Foxy Brown in terms of how it handles the tone of things and how much it's kind of just a hangout.
Yeah.
In many ways.
Yeah. Yeah, that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was great. I think it's one of the best movies of the year. And both the leads are so great in it. I mean, everybody is great in it, but Leo and Brad Pitt, phenomenal. Phenomenal. And Little Girl?
Of course.
Great. So, yeah, there it was, 1994. Pulp Fiction changed a lot of stuff, man. He obviously shook things up with Reservoir Dogs. You know what I mean? He announced himself as a major talent with that movie. Because I remember the first time I saw Reservoir Dogs, I was like, this is one of the best directorial debuts I've ever seen. You know, I mean, so confident and so funny. And we can thank Harvey Keitel, you know, for getting that movie made. He's the one who got behind it. But yeah, I, you know, so, but But like when Pulp Fiction came out, it was like, oh, okay,
we have arrived.
This is the guy.
Yeah,
he's the guy,
and he's part of that generation of directors, like with P.T. Anderson, and as well as Steven Soderbergh, who were kind of the brats. They were very anti film school, very much grew up on the VHS.
Yeah.
Boom. So the movies they were making were just so different and really, as you said, shook things up in ways that people in the mid to late 90s were not ready for.
I'll tell you what, I will say this, Heart 8 had a big effect on me. That was the first Paul Thomas Anderson movie I saw. And then, you know, because Heart 8 is just, it's a great film. And then, like, he knocked it out of the park with Boogie Nights and made a splash, not unlike what Tarantino did when he released Reservoir Dogs, and then, you know, followed that up with Pulp Fiction. There was a big, like, when Boogie Nights came out, I remember when Boogie Nights came out, it was just such a huge statement. And really confident. And he was just, you know, and he looks back at it now and he's like, yeah, I should have cut 20 minutes out of it. And he said that about Magnolia too. Where it's like Paul Thomas Anderson is like, man, you know, I was young. I think Pulp Fiction, he said, I think that Magnolia should be about a half an hour shorter. I don't agree with that. Because I think I think Magnolia, I mean, it's for people who are regular listeners, so the show's my favorite movie of all time. And I think it's perfect. I think it's a perfect movie. So, but anyway, you know, Jackie Brown became a big hit and got Robert Forrester an Oscar nomination. He just passed away. The journeyman actor whose comeback role as a bail bondsman in Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown earned him an Oscar nomination, who drew acclaim for his tough guy performances on the television series Breaking Bad and the reboot of Twin Peaks. He died on Friday at his home in Los Angeles. The cause was brain cancer. He was 78. He appeared in close to 200 films and television shows during his more than five decades in show business. He made his movie debut in 1967 in The Reflections in a Golden Eye. His most high-profile early role was as the star of Haskell Wexler's influential independent film Medium Cool. Mr. Forrester drew critical praise for his portrayal as a TV newsman caught up in the violence surrounding the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. And the film included documentary footage that was shot there, here in Chicago. If you've not seen that movie, you should. He was in the Delta Force. He was in Alligator. He's just, you know, reprised his role in El Camino, a Breaking Bad movie. So he was on Broadway a few times. And it was Jackie Brown that really was a big comeback for him. He will be missed. He was a terrific actor, a really, really terrific actor. So rest in peace, Robert Forrest. Okay, why don't we break here, and then we get the news coming up after this. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. I am your overnight dude every weekday morning from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich follows at 5 o'clock with the opening bell. The great Steve Cochran at 6 has your morning drive every day right here on 720 WGN. Okay. We were just talking about the fact that Pulp Fiction opened on this date 25 years ago, if you can even... God, it's amazing. It was 25 years. Wow. And obviously made a huge impact culturally and the world of pop culture and in movies and all that kind of stuff. And it cemented Tarantino as a filmmaker to be watched. And it did, you know, it did bring back Travolta. You know, people tend to forget, though. You know, everybody was like, oh, it's a big comeback for him. You know those stupid talking baby movies? Those movies made a lot of money. You know what I mean? People don't talk about that very often, but those movies, they made a lot of money.
Well, I think the less we can talk about the Who's Talking Now franchise, the better.
Yeah, no, but to be fair, though.
They made a ton of money.
They made a lot of money.
Was it him and Kirstie Alley?
Kirstie Alley, right? And the voice, Bruce Willis was the voice of the baby. And then Roseanne was the voice of another baby in the sequels.
Yeah.
Those movies made a ton, and they didn't cost anything. And people always go, oh, man, he hasn't had a hit in a long time. No, that's not true.
He didn't have a critical hit.
No, but it still made a lot of money. And people were like, "Oh yeah, he hasn't been in a big movie in a long time." Yes, he has. He's in those three stupid talking baby movies, and those made a lot of money.
Oh,
but in terms of critical and like just just a comeback performance, because clearly that was just a paycheck when he did the baby movies, But no, he's so good in Pulp Fiction. I love the scene with my favorite scene in the entire movie, not in the entire movie, but my favorite scene is the dinner scene when they
go Jackrabbits.
Yeah.
Do you just order a $5 shake?
Yeah. It's fantastic. And I just love the chemistry between the two of them.
Steve Buscemi as an uncredited role as a waiter dressed as Buddy Holly.
Yeah. That was so anyway, very memorable movie, came out, and it also has a great opening scene. You can't go wrong with Tim Roth. Honey Bunny. So we're talking about great opening scenes in movies. And we got a whole bunch of texts here that have come in. So let's see. Mark the Breadman says, in my opinion, the best opening scene in a movie is Fury Road. Yeah, when the credit finally pops up, when they're dragging Tom Hardy back in, they put that thing over his face and then they pull him back into the cave. That's a pretty extraordinary scene. And it's a hell of a way to kick off the movie. Yeah, well, everything about Fury Road is great. There's nothing that's not great about Fury Road. But yeah, that opening scene is something. 301 area code says, sad news about Robert Forrester. He had quite the roller coaster career, but always gave solid performances. I loved his short-lived Private Eye series, Banyan. Yeah, he was great. He was one of those reliable character actors, that had that second part of his career, which was really nice, that Jackie Brown was able to give him, that attention. And I don't care. I love Alligator. I love that movie. He's great in it. 815 area code says, I love Roger Avery and Quentin Tarantino's screenplay True Romance, which I found surprisingly better than I thought it would. It has a lot of stars in that one. Yeah, I'm not as crazy about True Romance as everybody else is. I think he should have directed it personally. But he loves Tony Scott. He loved Tony Scott. But I don't know. There are things about True Romance. To me, the best performance in True Romance is Brad Pitt. He's genius in that movie.
As the stoner roommate.
Oh, my. Why don't you get some cleaning products? Don't you condescend to me. He's genius in that movie.
He does a good job. I'll never forget Saul Rubinek in that movie.
Oh, he's great. Well, Saul Rubinek, that's one of those guys that you see him and you go, oh yeah, he's a character actor. He's been in a million things. I bet most people would probably remember him from he was the historian writer in Unforgiven. That's probably the part that everybody knows him from. But he's been in a ton of stuff, Saul Rubinek. And yeah, he's great. He's great in
he's insane.
Well, first of all, and also Bronson Pinchot. Where the cocaine blasts in his face when the cops pull him over. And you can't go wrong with Tom Sizemore. You can't.
Tom Sizemore and, yeah. What was it, Chris Penn?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The late, great Chris Penn. Yeah. Let's see. Jeff says in San Diego, he says, I was extremely lucky to see Pulp Fiction at the Chicago screening room on Lake Street 2 weeks before it opened. Yeah, I was there. I was in the same room. 815 area code says, my favorite opening scene is from 2006's Running Scared with Paul Walker. You know, that movie had no business being as good as it was. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that came out of nowhere. I mean, this was like Paul Walker was doing a bunch of crap movies in a row. And then that came out, I was like, whoa! 815 area code says, wasn't there a movie called Four Rooms about a hotel clerk? That was an awesome movie. I didn't think it was an awesome movie.
That was it's difficult.
It had moments.
Well, each section was directed by someone different, right?
Yeah. Well, I will say this. The whole cutting off the finger thing was hilarious. Tim Roth was weird because, like, his performance is really inconsistent in that movie because I think some of the directors let him... A couple of the directors let him go a little bit further because he's way over the top in a couple of...
Oh, yeah. Chewing scenery does not even begin
to
describe him.
So, yeah, I'm trying to remember who directed. Did Rodriguez direct one of them? Four Rooms? Because Tarantino directed the last one. And Allison... Oh,
It's Allison Anders.
Allison Anders. She directed the one with Madonna.
Yeah. Alexander Rockwell. Or right. Alexandra. I don't know how to pronounce it that way. And then Robert Rodriguez.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that was an interesting...
It was an experiment.
It was, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. All right. Oh, best opening scenes in movies. 312-981-7200. I guess a lot of people would say... Star Wars, with one of the most memorable opening shots of all time. You know, just the ship just looks like it's not going to end. And then you've seen Spaceballs,
of course. I love the way that they parodied that.
Well, yeah, I mean that the opening of Spaceballs was really. I'm mixed on Spaceballs. I think there's stuff in it that's funny. Combing the desert to me is my favorite moment in the entire movie. That and when they get the video of Spaceballs and they rewind it and they're watching it
now.
Yeah,
we're watching now.
Yeah, but I also like I did my favorite stuff in that movie was when they were making fun of the marketing, you know, of all the Star Wars stuff. But yeah, that opening scene, the opening shot of Spaceballs is really funny. All right, let's see. Here's Ike on WGN. Hey, Ike.
Hey, Nick. How's it going with you, man?
Good. What's up?
This is definitely one of my favorite opening scenes in movie history. It really got me into this filmmaker, John Carpenter, Escape from New York.
Yeah, now have you seen the beginning that was supposed to be in the movie, the robbery?
I did. I did see that.
Because in the original movie, I don't know if you know this, Tom, right?
Yeah,
they had the robbery sequence where they bust Snake Plissken.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great scene.
Sure.
But the opening itself with the guys trying to get away and then they just they blow them up. All right, Ike, thanks.
No problem.
All right.
Well, plus you've got the whole thing. Crime has risen, 800% in 10 years?
The crime rate, it's Jamie Lee Curtis. It's 1988. The crime rate rises 400%, I think it is. And then the movie takes place in 1997.
The horrible dystopian future.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the first couple of times I saw that movie, I didn't realize that was Jamie Lee Curtis doing the voiceover. I didn't realize it.
Once it gets pointed out, you're like, how did I do
it? Oh, yeah, exactly.
Because you're just like, oh, it does. Her. She's pretty distinct. But no, she does a good job. She just delivers it straight.
Fantastic. So, all right. Opening scenes in movies. Dazed and Confused, Sweet Emotion. Just Pickford driving around real slow in the car. Even the car looks high. You know what I mean?
Well, it really gets into like how the picture's going to feel.
Oh, you know, exactly.
This is exactly what it's about to feel like for about the next 2 hours.
Exactly. That's another one of my favorite movies. And I don't even know how many times I've seen it. I seriously do not know how many times I've seen Dazed and Confused. But yeah, that opening, you know, it's just iconic. 1970 GTO just cruising around the parking lot. That movie really, you know, I was around. That movie takes place on the final day of school, 1976. I was around Mitch Kramer's age at that time. And I knew all those guys. I knew all of them. And it's one of the most accurate portrayals of that time period ever. Like, just the laziness. Because there's nothing, you know, it's just like the whole, the last day of school, they're skipping classes. They're just walking around, getting a car, driving away.
barely getting in trouble.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that when I go back and rewatch that movie, I do wonder, did people really just not get in trouble for things in the 70s? Because they, especially, one of my favorite scenes is the car chase set to Jim Dandy.
Yeah.
And they're pulling stuff that no one should be getting away with. Like, there'd be calls coming in. The cops would be on you in 5 minutes.
It was a different time, man.
Yeah, that's...
It was a different time. And also, I think there's a little bit... I also think that it was a different time, and not only that, Texas.
That's true.
You know? I think some different rules apply in Texas.
My mom really loves the hazing stuff, because that's exactly what she was stuck doing in 1976.
Yeah.
Getting hazed to all hell.
Well, I remember when I was a freshman in high school, they would whip pennies at us.
That's a class. Oh, that never went away. That happened to me when I was in high school.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, but they were really, you know, zero tolerance about it, even though I didn't mind.
Well, I mean, these are like, you know, the upperclassmen.
Yeah, upperclassmen.
It was actually more sophomores, because they got it, they've got it when they were freshmen. So they were like waiting so that when they were sophomores, they were going to gun us with the pennies. But that was, I never understood that tradition.
Did you ever... In any school you went to, was there ever an elevator?
No.
Like a freight elevator?
No.
When I was in middle school, about Mitch Kramer's age, they would do this thing. There was a easily reachable freight elevator, and they would tell 6th graders, they'd tell 6th graders, oh, yeah, you can use the elevator, you just have to have an elevator pass.
Oh, no.
And they would make fake elevator passes and give them to 6th graders, and they'd go and they'd get in the elevator. And then the custodian would be like, what the hell are you doing in here? It's like, oh, I had an elevator pass, man. It was horrible.
Never heard that before.
Oh, it was horrible.
Yeah.
People were really mean about it, too.
All right, let's take a break. We're talking about best opening scenes in movies. There's a ton to choose from. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. And we'll get back to it after this. Right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are talking about movies with great opening scenes, and that's one right there. Bring to mind Dazed and Confused. So there it is. But what are some of your favorites? We got Mad Max Fury Road. We've already mentioned that one. There Will Be Blood is mentioned, which is really an astonishing opening scene. No dialogue. Yeah.
It still tells you almost everything you need to know about who we're dealing with.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a great movie. Oh.
Who knew oil could be interesting?
Paul Thomas Anderson, what are you going to say about that guy? You like Phantom Thread?
Not as much as his other stuff, but I still really enjoyed it. I had a good time with it. I thought the performance that Daniel Day-Lewis put on was pretty astonishing.
And so is his female lead.
Yeah,
so
absolutely. Yeah. No, all the performances
went toe to toe with him all the way through. I love that movie.
Yeah.
It's also really weird.
It's very strange.
It's a weird movie. Yeah.
I think Inherent Vice doesn't get talked about enough. I think it shows how bold P.T. Anderson is, because who adapts Thomas Pynchon?
Yeah.
You can't do that, but he did.
It's a crazy movie, and Joaquin is nuts in it. He's also great in The Master. Two great performances from Joaquin. Let's see. 301 area code. We got some texts coming in. If you guys want to jump in here, best opening scenes in movies. 301 area code says, some great film openings that come to mind. The Warriors and Touch of Evil. Well, Touch of Evil, what can you say about the opening, Touch of Evil? One of the greatest long takes in the history of film. And it's restored now, because they used to have the opening credits, music would play on it. They used to have the opening credits play over it, which is really distracting. But they went back to no opening credits during that entire thing. That's my favorite Orson Welles movie. I like it more than Citizen Kane.
I'm a third man myself, even though Orson Welles wasn't. Oh, yeah, it's true. I just like his performance in it.
No, he's great.
Harry Lime.
Yeah, he's great in it. It's a great movie. Yeah. 708 area code, Baby Driver. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the opening of Baby Driver. That's how you kick off a movie right there.
Well, I remember they were pretty bold about the marketing because they released the entire opening scene online to watch.
Of Baby Driver?
Yeah, when it first came out, probably about a week or two prior to, they had the entire opening heist.
Wow.
Because I think they wanted to get people into the idea of what this movie was going to be, which is ostensibly a musical.
It is.
And I think it might have been a smart thing for them to do, because then people kind of got into what was going to happen instead of being like, whoa, why is everybody, like, why is everything timed out? Why is everything on beat?
Yeah.
It's because it's a musical.
Yeah. Bell bottoms. Bell bottoms. That scene, the scene, in for me, I mean, the opening scene of Baby Driver is fantastic. It does have it. But the scene for me is Hocus Pocus by Focus. That foot chase, I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
And the bullet, the sounds of the bullets are timed up.
Yeah, perfectly. Brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. 708 area code, Jaws. Great opening scene. She became like an icon. The actress who is in that opening scene, and the guy that she's with, drunk, passes out on the beach
with his pants halfway down.
Idiot. 479 area code says opening scene, Once Upon a Time in the West with Elam. Yeah, Jack Elam. You can't go wrong with him and his crazy eyes. He's got crazy eyes. You ever see the Cannonball Run movies?
Yeah.
All right. How about this one? Monty Python and the Holy Grail. The horse galloping in the distance turns out to be coconuts.
Come along, Patsy.
You know, that they did that on purpose because they couldn't afford horses. So they were like, let's just use coconuts. And it became iconic, obviously. I hosted a screening of Monty Python and the Holy Grail as part of my film club a few years ago, and we gave out coconuts. They were official Monty Python and the Holy Grail coconuts. Still not my favorite Python movie.
No, it's not Life of Brian.
Life of Brian is my favorite Python movie.
I think a lot of people who are real Python heads, it's Life of Brian.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, they're all great.
Yeah.
They're all great. My dad's favorite comedy scene in the history of movies is in Meaning of Life. It's the fat guy throwing up. My dad just falls off the couch. I remember I had the VHS copy of it when I was in high school when the movie came out, and my dad would just rewind that scene over and over again. It's a whiff of thin. Better get a bucket because I'm going to puke.
It's so gross.
It's fantastic. Oh.
God, it's funny, but it's so
the best.
Gross.
The best part of it is when he just pukes all over the cleaning woman. When the cleaning woman comes out to clean him, he just goes, "Ah!" I'm telling you, my dad falls off the couch laughing.
I can see it. I can see it.
He just loves that scene. All right, great opening scenes. This is. Come on now, Goodfellas. As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. Yeah, that's a great, I mean, that's the deal right there. God, Goodfellas, what a great movie that is. I mean, that's obvious, goes without saying, but yeah. That's a movie with a great opening scene. That noise in the trunk, Goodfellas, is brilliant. So, all right, we're talking about great opening scenes in movies. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. Lots of great movies. They also picked The Player. Which is that one long crazy take where people are just pitching ideas and stuff. That's another movie that I'm not as crazy about as everybody else.
I really like The Player.
I like it.
Tim Robbins, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh.
I like it, but I don't love it as much as everybody else does.
That's fair.
So.
That's fair.
All right, let's take a break here. We got the news coming up, but we're going to break, and then we're going to come back and talk more. Great opening scenes in movies. 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Happy to be back. I was sick over the weekend. Still got a little cold going on, but man, it was pretty brutal over the weekend. Watch out for these viruses here. Wash your hands and eat your vitamins. I'm glad to be back. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time on a Monday morning. And we are talking about movies with great opening scenes. They really establish something. They really knock it out of the park with really, really, really great opening scenes. So we want to hear from you guys. What are your favorite movies that have the best opening scenes? 312-981-7200. We've been talking about some of the iconic stuff like Jaws. And you know, obviously Star Wars has that infamous opening shot that nobody, you know, everybody loves. And, yeah, so that's what we're talking about here. And here's Mark on WGN. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Nick. How you doing?
All right. What's up?
Blade. I thought the opening to the first Blade movie was pretty awesome.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I remember the first time I saw Blade was at a screening, and Wesley Snipes had made, like, four movies in a row that were terrible. Like, he did the one that takes place, the White House or whatever. I mean, he did like four movies in a row that were really, really bad, like Boiling Point and Passenger 57, just these really stupid movies. And I remember going in to see Blade with the worst expectations possible, like the lowest expectations. I was like, oh, this is going to be another stupid Wesley Snipes movie. And that opening 10 minutes, I was like, this is the greatest movie ever. This is the greatest movie I've ever seen.
I waited till it came on back then, you know, VHS, and I ended up watching it twice back to back. I'm like, this is awesome.
It's fantastic, and it's really that opening scene is unbelievable in Blade. It totally won me over. I was really, really negative on it, and then as soon as that opening scene happened, I was like, wow, yeah, that's a great movie. All right, thanks, Mark.
Can I throw one other one in real quick? One of my all-time favorite movies, Risky Business.
Oh, well,
I don't know if you guys talked about that one or not.
Well, Risky Business is one of my favorite movies of all time, and I love the opening. I love the opening scene. The dream is always the same.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I love that movie. All right, Mark, thanks.
Okay,
take
bye.
Care. Yeah. Risky Business was my favorite movie, until I saw Magnolia. And so my two favorite movies, my top two favorite movies, both have Tom Cruise in them, which is just a coincidence, I think. But no, Risky Business was one of those movies that, when that movie came out, I was 18, and it was right before I was going to go to college. I just graduated high school, and I was going to college, and I'm here, I'm 18 years old, and I'm seeing this movie that is really, it was kind of a life-changing thing for me. And I just remember how dark it was, you know, on how it dealt with, because it was that movie came out, Risky Business came out at a time when there was a high school TNA movie that would come out every week. There was a Porky's or whatever it was. Those were the really popular movies. And so when that one came out, I thought it was just going to be yet another one of those, you know, teen sex comedies. And it's so much more. And a great opening scene. Yep. How about this one, Rear Window? If you want to, you want a fantastic opening scene. Yeah. Establishing everything in the courtyard. That is obviously, you know, I'm stating the obvious here, but Rear Window, you know Rear Window? That's a good movie. That's a pretty good movie. It's a I mean, that whole opening sequence where it's everything is laid out for you, you know, the whole courtyard. It is great. That's like a perfect movie, though, Rear Window.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just genius. I still like Vertigo more. I'm still a Vertigo guy. But yeah, that's an opening right there. All right, here's Paula on WGN. Hi, Paula.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm glad you're back and well.
Thank you.
I missed you. I got two musical ones and one sort of a film noir type. John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever, and the Moon River opening with her Audrey Hepburn eating breakfast at Tiffany's. Yep. They sort of set the whole scenes for the movie.
Yeah. I mean, both of them are so iconic. I mean, I remember when Saturday Night Fever came out, that whole opening scene was just like, here's a movie star. He's now, you know, he was Bob Marino, but now he's a movie star.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we've got, I hope everybody has seen Kiss Me Deadly.
Oh, yeah.
Lars Leachman running down that road with nothing underneath that coat.
Yep. Absolutely. Classic. That's a classic. All right, Paula, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Good night.
Okay. See ya. So we're talking about movies that have great opening scenes that really establish something. So Saturday Night Fever, Staying Alive, that's considered a classic. I just remember, I mean, just how iconic that was when it opened. So let's see. They got Fight Club here. Fight Club, just the you know, going from inside the brain all the way out, you know, the barrel of the gun is in Edward Norton's mouth. Yeah. And David Fincher has an affinity for really great opening credits. Like, his opening credits are really great. Like Seven. Mm-hmm. Seven is one of my favorite opening credit sequences.
Set to Nine Inch Nails.
Panic Room. Fight Club.
Social Network's opening scene is...
Well, the opening scene, yeah. I mean,
opening scene is impeccable.
When that scene was over, when that scene was done, and they moved on, and then the credit started. As soon as that scene was over, I was like, "Well, Aaron Sorkin just won the Oscar." That opening scene alone, the opening scene of Social Network, I was like, "Yeah, he won the Oscar," and he did. God, that's a good movie.
It's also that scene is painfully awkward in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Because it's just, ooh, God.
Yeah, 630 area code says, Reservoir Dogs, the breakfast diner scene is great. Yeah, Like a Virgin. Discussing the intricacies of Like a Virgin.
Whenever Quentin Tarantino pops up in a movie and share one of his insane theories,
yeah,
it's always so funny. Yeah. The Top Gun bit.
Yeah, what was the name of that movie?
Oh, my God.
It was Eric Stoltz. Sleep With Me.
That's it.
Yeah. Tim says, Trinity being featured in the new bullet time in the original the original Matrix has a killer opening. That's a great, yeah. God, that's a good movie. Did you see? You saw it in the theater a few months ago, right? A couple of months ago when it was re-released?
Yeah, I saw it in the Dolby Cinema. And then I think Music Box is doing 35 next month.
Right.
They're going to do that, so I'll go see it again.
It was so great to see it on the big screen again. We saw it in the Dolby Cinema, too. It was one of my favorite movie experiences of this year.
Well, just your chair is shaking.
That movie
wild.
Is unbelievable. 608 area code says, one of my favorite openings is actually a pair of scenes. The Princess Bride. I think Rob Reiner did a beautiful job setting the lovely tone with the film with Peter Falk and Fred Savage, and then Cary Elwes and Robin Wright. People adore that movie. That's one of the, seriously, that's probably one of the most beloved movies of all time. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. The way people talk about it is, I mean, I like it, but I'm not going to pop it in. Just because I'm like, oh, you know what? I want to watch a movie. I'm going to put on Princess Bride.
Yeah,
but it is really, really.
It's
great.
Entertaining, and I like it. I'm not as nuts about it as so many other people are. But it's got a following, man.
The Billy Crystal stuff, I think, is the best when it's him and his. They're like the wizard and the witch.
Yeah,
has me.
Carol Kane.
Yeah,
yeah.
It makes me laugh every time.
Wallace Shawn kills me in the movie.
Yeah,
Wallace Shawn kills me. But yeah, no, it's a classic, man. It's a classic. 847 area code, Gangs of New York opening scene is my personal favorite. Yeah, it's a great opening. 630, Children of Men, all of Children of Men.
That's a tough movie to watch. I can't watch it without being immensely depressed afterwards because it just feels too real. It just feels so, so precious.
I love that movie.
It's great, but it's like.
I love that movie. And yeah, the opening is amazing.
You put that on at 11 a.m., you're not going to do anything for the rest of the day because you'll just be thinking about just the horrors of the end of the world.
Yeah. I hosted a screening of this of Children of Men, and it was the year it was the year of the campaign of the election, and it felt weird watching that movie. You know what I mean? Like what was happening during the campaign?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was like we were all like, "Oh my God!" Just the opening scene alone, we were like, "Oh," you know. It's a great movie though, Alfonso Cuarón, the man, and I love Clive Owen is phenomenal in that movie, and so is Michael Caine.
What makes me sad is that what is Clive Owen? He's in Gemini Man.
Yeah.
But really, what has he been doing? He had a really good run in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And then he just started taking these roles that are just so bad.
Well, I like Shoot 'Em Up.
Well, Shoot 'Em Up, yeah. Shoot 'Em Up,
I thought Shoot 'Em Up was cool. And I like The International. Like, four people saw that movie.
I had no idea what was going on in
that
The International.
That scene, the shootout scene in the Guggenheim? Yeah. Unbelievable.
It was great, but I have no attachment to what's happening. I'm like, wow, this would be really cool if I cared.
Yeah.
It was beautifully shot, but I was like, what is this? Isn't it about like international banking or something?
Yeah.
I had no clue what was happening.
Do we have weather? Yeah, we're going to get weather here in a second. Let me give it to you. 570 area code says the opening scene in Apocalypse Now. Well, it certainly sets a tone. Certainly sets a tone, man. 708 area code, Full Metal Jacket, The Shining in 2001. Someone likes Kubrick and thinks Kubrick makes great movies with great openings. Tim says, as far as setting the tone for a movie, I think the opening scene of The Witch is perfect. Man, that's a good movie. So, what are we thinking here? 312-981-7200. Talking about great opening scenes in movies. And I want to hear from you guys. But let's break for the weather and we'll come back. 312-981-7200. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Skyline Studio. 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and it is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we are talking about movies that have really, really great opening scenes that really suck you in, that really establish the mood, and that just have great opening scenes. So we want to hear from you at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell, and the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. In just a few minutes. A bunch of texts have come in, and and we want to talk about movies that have great opening scenes. What are your favorites? Here's Ron on WGN. Hi, Ron.
Good morning, Nick.
Morning.
Nick, I got two movies. Number one is Fury, where Brad Pitt is standing. You know, you can't see nothing until the gloom rises, and he jumps on a bare-backed horse rider and cuts his head off. And
yeah.
That's the movie just, you know, descends or... rises to more violence and beauty, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But the other movie, which is Duelists, which starts out with the beautiful pastoral scenes of, you know, rural France, and then two guys getting into a duel, and the other guy, you know, virtually slaughters the other guy, and then again it descends or rises to, you know, more beauty with the costumes and the scenery and the violence just keeps rising.
Yeah.
I think those are two great movies, in my opinion.
Yeah. Okay, thank Ron.
You're welcome,
Take
Nick.
Take care, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I haven't seen The Duelist in a long time. Ridley Scott.
Yeah, that's his first picture, right?
I don't think it's his first. One of his first. But, yeah. I mean, I know it was before Alien and Blade Runner. It was Harvey Keitel, Robert Carradine. Is that who's in it? Keith Carradine.
I'm pulling it out. Harvey Keitel, Keith Carradine, Albert Finney.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's the directorial debut of Ridley.
That was his first movie.
Yeah, 1978.
Okay. We're talking about movies with great opening scenes. 815 area code says Basic Instinct. I don't even remember the opening for Basic Instinct. Isn't it just a sex scene and then she kills the guy and then a guy gets killed with an ice pick?
I haven't seen Basic Instinct in a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason.
Yeah, no.
248 area code says Once Upon a Time in America. Well, you got to make sure you get the full 4-hour version. 219 area code says up. Ugh. Ugh. I remember the first time I saw Up, man. I mean, you know, the Pixar movies make me cry. I think they make everybody cry. I think they're, you know, it's illegal to make a Pixar movie that doesn't make you cry. But usually it's like towards the end, at least. Because I've cried. I can't even tell you the number of Pixar movies that have made me cry over the years. But right out of the gate, though, I mean, the first 10 minutes of Up, I was like, what are you doing to me? I mean, you know, like I was saying, Tom, you know you're going to cry when you see a Pixar movie. I didn't expect to cry 5 minutes into Up.
Yeah, like, no,
like that's sobbing,
cheating.
Like sobbing.
Come on, you know.
Oh,
I've only got one packet of puffs. You know,
I mean, I
so
can't.
Much.
I don't even. It's such a great movie, but that opening 10 minutes is brutal, man.
It's a tough one.
It's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking.
But it gets you. It does exactly what it needs to do. It gets you into the emotional.
Listen,
state.
I love that movie.
Yeah,
I love that
so
movie.
Good.
My favorite Pixar movie though is WALL-E. That's still my favorite Pixar movie. That movie kills me too. 219 area code says best opening scene is movie Super Troopers. I don't even remember how Super Troopers starts.
That's when they pull the guys over.
Okay.
Littering and.
Yeah. Well, you know, that one idiot in the back seat is married to Christina Hendricks, which I just can't.
I know.
It just makes me sick. Yeah. It makes me sick.
He must have a great personality.
Oh, my God. Just but like, that guy is with Christina Hendricks?
But it's super. I love the opening to Super Troopers.
Yeah, no, that's the funniest scene in the movie, I think. Super Troopers was funny. The second one wasn't.
No, I still love popping in Super Troopers every once in a while.
Yeah. All right, let's see. Here's Dave on WGN. Hi, Dave. Dave?
Oh, good morning.
Yes.
Good morning. I'm glad you're back. I'm glad you're feeling better, Lou.
Thank you.
Oh, I've got two movies that are... first one is Freaks. The opening of that was so eerie and scary at the same time.
Yeah.
I didn't really understand what I was looking at in the beginning, and when I realized it just freaked me out. The second one was Mean Streets, where Johnny Boy blew up the mailbox.
Yeah.
and that the fight scene in the pool hall was.
I love that movie and I love that scene. Mean Streets is such a good movie.
When that one guy said, "What the hell is a mook?"
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny as hell.
All right, Dave. Thanks.
Okay. All right, thanks, Lou.
All right, man. Yeah, I love Mean Streets. Also, one of the best film representations of being drunk ever put in a movie, when Harvey Keitel is blasted and it's like the handheld camera. That's like the best cinematic, you know, the best cinematic way to play drunk, to feel it. That movie is just so good. It's just so good.
It's crazy to think is that Scorsese's debut as well.
No. Who's that knocking on my door?
Oh, right.
Yeah,
but Mean Streets.
Oh, it's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
It's a masterpiece. Never get tired of it either. I've seen it like 800 times. So, all right. You guys, hang on. We got a break here. We got the news coming up, and then we'll come back, and we're going to talk more about movies that have really, really, really great opening scenes. And we want to hear from you at WGN. Black helicopters, man. Stirring the sauce. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And we've been having some fun here talking about movies that have fantastic opening scenes. So some classics. And if you want to jump in, 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to jump in. And here's Pete on WGN. Hi, Pete.
Hi, good morning. Love your show.
Thank you.
And I hope you feel better. How about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, where the lady goes out, the little girl goes out, Mr. Mister, have you got your bag? And the whole building blows up.
Mm. Yeah, it's the Untouchables, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And then my second one is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Totally classic movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are classics. Those are good ones. All right, Pete, thanks.
Thanks. Have
okay.
a good night.
Okay, take care. I got to be honest with you. I don't remember how Planes, Trains, and Automobiles starts. And how does it start? What's the first scene?
Oh, God, I don't remember. I mean, I watch it maybe once a year.
Yeah.
But it's around Thanksgiving, usually, when I'm in a food coma.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, that's when you watch it. You watch it Thanksgiving.
Yeah. I remember the Steve Martin cursing out scene.
Oh, my God.
Which is hilarious. So funny.
Oh, my God. That's the only reason that movie got an R rating. Just that one scene. Otherwise, it's like perfectly sort of like family friendly. And you know the actress who was in the car rental.
Yeah.
Edie McClurg.
Yeah.
Please. Yeah, that's actually a really funny movie. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. So, all right, how about this? Did you ever see the movie Lord of War?
Yeah, that's Nick Cage, Jared Leto.
Yeah.
Jared Leto, for some reason, is doing his Eastern European accent, even though Nick Cage is definitely not.
Yeah. Well, they have the opening sequence of that. It's a great opening sequence.
Yeah, The Life of a Bullet.
Yeah. Also, another thing about that movie, because I like Lord of War. I think it's a good film. Also, one of the best movie posters ever.
Yeah, where he's made partially of bullets.
It's fantastic. All right, what else we got here? Patton. Opening scene of Patton. Well, that establishes George C. Scott, man. Yeah, we got The Social Network as mentioned here with the breakup. Apocalypse Now. This is the end.
The only way I could get you to listen to The Doors is if we put on the opening scene of Apocalypse Now.
Children of Men, the cafe explosion at the beginning. Boogie Nights. That opening scene, the opening shot. Yeah, that is a really great opening shot too. That whole long take that goes into the club, follows Louis Guzman, and then it ends up on a close up of Mark Wahlberg, establishing a bunch of characters. You got Roller Girl in there. Yeah, that whole opening is fantastic. It really is. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. We're talking about movies that have great opening scenes. That are just classic. Boogie Nights being one of them. Yeah. All right. Let's see. Here's Bruce on WGN. Hi, Bruce.
Hey, Nick. What's up, buddy? How you doing?
I'm okay. What's up?
I missed you on Sunday, man. I'm sorry, Thursday night. So I'm glad you're feeling better. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles starts out with Steve Martin and Kevin Bacon trying to catch the same
right.
cab.
Right.
On different sides of the sidewalk.
Right.
You know?
No, that's right. That's right. Because they're sitting in the office at the beginning, and the guy just keeps looking at the guy's not, their boss is not saying anything. He's just looking at the advertising, just turning it upside down and sideways.
Oh, yeah. And then Kevin Bacon, for whatever reason, is in that movie. I don't know why, you know, but
yeah.
Pretty funny.
Well, that's, so, you know, Kevin Bacon's in that movie because they work together on She's Having a Baby.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, they had just finished She's Having a Baby, and so they put a fake mustache on Kevin Bacon and had them do the taxi thing. So.
Nice.
Yeah. All right, Bruce. All right, thanks, buddy. Take care.
Yep.
Yeah, I had forgotten how Planes, Trains, and Automobiles started. Funny. How about Vertigo? Oh man, the opening of Vertigo, the rooftop chase. Poor Jimmy Stewart.
And the camera technique is just—it's still effective. The woo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's fantastic.
Used everywhere.
Yeah.
I think the first time I actually saw that technique being used was in The Lord of the Rings, of all places.
Mm.
Because there's the bit where they're standing, you know, where they get out of the road. And he sees, he does a thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And shortens it. And I'd never seen anything like that. I was like, wow, how could you possibly do that? I assumed it was probably a computer or something. But no, it's totally,
yeah,
totally organic.
Pull the camera back, push in the focus. There it is.
That's simple, but so effective.
Well, how about in Jaws?
Yeah, yeah.
Roy Scheider sitting on the beach. That whole thing right there, man. Yeah, no, that is a technique that is used a million times. So, all right, here's Ron on WGN. Hi, Ron.
Hey. So I'm embarrassed to say this, but one of my favorite guilty pleasure, so bad we enjoy it, movies is
what movie are you talking about?
Battleship.
Oh God. Okay.
Yeah. So bad it's become comical in our house.
Yeah.
And the opening scene is one of our favorites, where Taylor Kitsch decides to hit on Brooklyn Decker, and she wants a chicken burrito, and he has to break into the 7-Eleven and basically almost kills himself, and then walks across the street, and he gets tased as he hands her the chicken burrito.
I don't remember any of this.
So, do yourself a favor, watch like the first 3 minutes of the movie, and then turn it off. It's a really funny movie.
Yeah. All right. Okay, Ron. Thanks, man.
Yeah. All
okay.
Right.
Battleship.
That's shocking, but good for him. He knows, he's aware.
Yeah. This Taylor Kitsch guy, what's going on with that guy?
I don't know.
Wasn't he supposed to have like a big career?
Yeah, is Taylor, he's the one from Friday Night Lights, the show.
Yeah.
He's Riggins.
Yeah.
Tim Riggins. And then he did that John Carter movie and it totally blew.
Oh my God, John Carter. Boy, they were going to make that a franchise.
They really thought they were. Not so.
What was it, the full title, John Carter from Mars, or Mars is John Carter lives in Mars, or
yeah, that was the story it was based on. It was kind of like a space version. It's like just space pulp that was fairly popular in its day when, you know, the dime store novel was a pretty big thing.
I don't know where they were gonna. I don't know what they were thinking though. That was Disney, right?
Yeah, directed by Andrew Stanton.
Oh, God, that's right.
And it totally, almost, it pretty much tanked his career.
He's a good filmmaker, at least in animation.
Yeah. Did not work out so well for him.
All right. You ready for another great opening? Movie great opening? What can you say about Halloween? What can you say about John Carpenter's Halloween? One of the greatest opening scenes of all time.
Uses the frame to its fullest.
Beautiful use of cuts, so it all looks like one take, even though it's not. And you know whose hands those are. You know who's holding the knife.
I know it's a woman. It's a woman.
It's Deborah Hill.
Deborah Hill, yeah.
Yeah.
Bless her. Oh, my God.
Yeah. She opens up the kitchen drawer, takes the butcher knife out. That's Deborah. That's Deborah Hill. The late, great Deborah Hill. Yeah, it doesn't get much better than Halloween. As far as opening a movie, that's like, I remember the first time I saw that movie. I've talked about this before. Seeing Halloween was a life changing event for me. Like it really was the movie where I first realized what a director did. Like I saw that movie and I was like, whoa. I mean, I'd been a movie fan my whole life already. You know, I was 13, so I had seen tons and tons and tons of movies already. But it was the first movie where I ever saw where I was like, okay. And then I remember after the movie went out, saw it at the State Lake Theater, after the movie went out and looked at the poster to see who the director's name was. Because it was really the first time I'd ever went, oh, that's how you direct, that's what the director does. And of course, still, John Carpenter's my favorite director. But yeah, that opening scene, man, completely, completely brilliant.
So good.
Yeah. So that's one of the best opening scenes ever, I would have to say. All right. Great opening scenes. That's what we're talking about. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. Why don't we take a break here and give you some weather, and then we'll come back and talk more. Phone lines are open at 312-981-7200. Also, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke in just a little bit right here on a Monday morning.
I'm ready.
All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke in a little bit, and that's because it's a jokey time. And we've been talking about movies that have really, really great opening scenes. If you would like to call us in, and we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. Next one, written about in this article, Trainspotting.
Choose a Life.
Please, man. That movie was a big deal when that movie came out. I love that movie and I love the sequel. I thought the sequel was great.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I mean that was another one of those movies that, I must have seen it Bruinview like 50 times. It would just, you know, we would go, let's go see Trainspotting. What do you want to do? Let's just go see Trainspotting.
Yeah.
Again.
I remember when I was in high school auditioning for a play, you had to pick a monologue, but the director didn't care. He's just like, you can pull from a movie, a play, wherever you want, do a monologue. So I did that.
Did you choose Life?
Yeah, I did the opening monologue from Trainspotting. I got the role. And the reason I did is because I was playing a drug addict.
Oh.
And so.
You're playing a drug addict in high school?
Yeah, we got edgy. It was good. A very good play. I can't remember what it was, but I just remember I had to play a drug addict.
That's kind of weird.
Mm-hmm. I even lost weight for it.
Times were different, I guess, when I went to high school, because we weren't doing drug plays in high school.
It was The Music Man.
Doing stuff, yeah, or Tartuffe or something.
Tartuffe. I do love Tartuffe.
I do, too. But, yeah, no, it was not. It was, you know, there were no drug addicts in the...
Listen, man, I come from the mean streets of Crystal Lake, Illinois.
Yeah, okay. All righty, then. Yeah. See, here's Bruce on WGN. Hi, Bruce.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
All right, what's up?
The opening scenes, every time it comes on, I got to watch the first part of Dark Knight.
Ah.
That bank robbery scene is just a wonder to watch.
Yeah, two of my friends are in that scene.
Oh, absolutely. That's great.
Yeah, two of my friends are in that scene in the opening of Dark Knight. You can't see them. I will say this, though. One of my friend Matt, he's one of them, and it's my friend Matt and Sandy Smiley are two of the clowns that are part of the bank robbery. You don't see their faces. But I will say this. My friend Matt is the guy that gets shot by William Fichter with the shotgun.
Yeah.
That's Matt. He's very proud of the fact that he got killed by William Fichter.
Is that the same Matt that was in the vinyl store?
Vinyl shop.
Vinyl
yes.
shop. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's him. Yeah, that's him. And then another buddy of mine is in Dark Knight. My friend Mike View. He's the guy on the in the courtroom where he pulls the gun on Aaron Eckhart.
Yeah. Hostile? I'll show you Hostile.
Yeah, that's Mike. That's my buddy Mike. Known him forever.
I always loved his performance. I thought that was a great scene with him.
Yeah.
I'll show you Hostile.
Well, he got to hang out. He was all excited because he got to hang out with Eric Roberts. He was one of his heroes. And I've got some Eric Roberts stories, as I'm sure most people do. Have you seen Eric Roberts in the walk-in tub commercials?
Oh, yeah. He's selling me on it, honestly. I might get a walk-in tub.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Bruce. Talking about The Dark Knight. That's considered, I think, the opening of that movie. A lot of people love the opening of that movie. I'm not a fan of The Dark Knight at all.
Yeah. I think it was the first time, though, I had ever seen a movie start in a different aspect ratio.
Well, it starts in IMAX.
Starts in IMAX.
Yeah. That scene was shot. That scene was shot in IMAX.
Yeah.
And then, but I saw it at Navy Pier.
In IMAX.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was weird because like it would switch because only certain scenes were shot in IMAX.
Yeah.
So sometimes the screen was full and sometimes it wasn't. I found it really distracting.
Yeah. I got used to it over the years, but I'm not a big fan of, and he's not the first filmmaker to do that, to do scenes in different aspect ratios. And I always find it jarring unless it's justified somehow. Like there's an in movie reason why it's happening. Like it's a perspective thing.
Well, he's always changing things up. Isn't he? His next movie, isn't it shot in 65?
Might be.
I think his next movie, there's already a trailer for it.
I haven't watched a trailer because I'm pretty uninterested. I'm not a big Nolan guy. I pick and choose a few of his movies.
Okay, but there are a few movies that he made that I love. I love Dunkirk.
Dunkirk was great.
Dunkirk.
I did get a noise complaint, though, because when I watched it, they were like, it's too loud. You're playing video games too loud. I was like, oh, I'm watching Dunkirk.
Oh, you mean at the theater?
No, at my house.
At your house?
I was watching it at home. I was like, oh, I should probably watch this a little bit on the louder side, you know, really experience
You're cranking
it.
Up the Dunkirk?
Yeah, everything's, there's bombs going
off. I thought you meant
off,
at the theater.
No. No.
As far as Nolan goes, you know my favorite Nolan movie. You hate it.
They all start with eyes, but yeah. I don't know how.
Interstellar.
It's crazy. I'm not saying that anybody's like bad in it. It's just.
That movie destroys me. I sob. I sob like a baby when I watch that movie.
Can't do it. Can't do it, man. I respect it, but
I like Inception a lot.
Inception's great. Love Inception.
And I like Insomnia.
Yeah.
So. But yeah, and then Dunkirk I think is great too.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, my favorite Nolan movie without question is Interstellar. So I get a lot of crap from Rod Pyle about that though. Every time he's on, he's gotta give me a dig about my love for Interstellar.
I'll tell you though, when I get him on the phone, he's like, "Hey, you want to make fun of him for Interstellar?" I said, "Ah, not this time. We'll give him a break this month."
So anyway, all right. How about this? An establishing. You ever see Sunset Boulevard on the big screen?
No, that's one of my great regrets.
I saw it. One of my favorite movie going experiences in my life was seeing Sunset Boulevard at the Music Box. Because it's just such an extraordinary movie. And the opening of that is so fantastic. The opening scene. And also the last scene. But yeah, the opening scene of Sunset Boulevard is mentioned here as one of the greatest opening sequences of all time. And justifiably so. I just love the fact, one of my favorite things about that movie is that it's narrated by a dead guy. I just think that's fantastic. I just love that.
I'm ready for my close-up, Mr.
It's,
DeVille.
Man, narrated by a dead guy. What was it? There was another movie that was narrated by a dead guy.
Oh, I mean, there's a few.
Yeah, but I mean, there was one that... A
big famous one, narrated by a dead...
Oh, man.
Who narrates American Beauty?
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, it's American Beauty.
Yeah. That's it. Kevin Spacey. Dead. I hate that movie.
Everybody. It's in a complete 180 over the last 20 years.
Yeah, he won Best Picture.
Best Picture.
He won Best Actor.
Yeah, Sam Mendes.
By the way,
like
that was 1999. Do you know how many other great movies came out that year deserved to win that?
Yeah. Hey, man, things change. Yeah. Attitudes change.
I will say this. Sam Mendes has made a couple of good movies, one of which is one of my favorite movies, and that's Away We Go, with John Krasinski and Maya Rudolph. I love that movie.
It's one of the cutest movies I've ever seen.
I love that movie. It's just so good. And everybody else who's in it, Allison Janney is hysterically funny in that movie. Jim Gaffigan.
Maggie Gyllenhaal,
who's great. Josh Charles.
Do you want to get in the stroller, Wolfie?
Yeah. Come on, Wolfie. That's actually one of my favorite scenes ever. That's a really good movie. That's got a great opening scene, too. That establishes the whole opening. I can't talk about it on the air, but it does have a great opening scene. So... all right, we got a ton of texts coming in here. We are talking about movies that have great and memorable opening scenes that really establish right out of the gate that you're going to see something great. And if you want to jump in, we'd love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Some texts coming in. We got more thoughts about this from the website here. And we're talking about great movie opening scenes. And there's a lot more to talk about. Let's see. For instance, 815 area code says, Nick, opening to Saving Private Ryan, horrifically mesmerizing and sad. It's the best part of the movie. The first 15, 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan, by far the best part of the movie. Then to me, it just falls apart. But that opening, there's no denying how powerful that opening sequence is.
A masterful work of cinematography and direction.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yep. Really scary, terrifying stuff. All right. All right, let's take a break here. We got the news coming up, and then we'll come back and wrap up the show, talk more about movies that have great beginnings, and my dad will call in and tell a joke as well. That's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. We've been talking about movies that have great opening scenes that really establish a great opening scene. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. And let's see. 815 area code says Blade Runner is a great opening. Yes, Blade Runner is a fantastic opening scene. Really establishes the special effects and the world of in Los Angeles. Of 2019, in fact. So 570 area code says Carnival of Souls. Great opening scene. 773 area code says Inglourious Basterds machine gunning the farmhouse floor. That scene goes on forever, doesn't it? The opening scene of Inglourious Basterds?
Yeah, but it sustains its tension throughout. It is a nerve-wracking sort of scene.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. I love the opening of it where they have just like the conversation, the milk and everything like that.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when Hitchcock would talk about like if there's a bomb underneath a table and right. The audience knows it's there, but you know, the other characters don't.
Yeah.
That's just so intense.
Yeah. I haven't seen that movie in a long time, Inglourious Basterds. It's been a while. Yeah.
I think it holds up incredibly well.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I don't doubt that it holds up at all. And I thought I love Brad Pitt in that movie. He's hilarious in it.
I got some Apache in me.
He's hilarious in it. It's the accent that he's doing.
Well, especially when they have to pretend they're Italian.
Yeah.
Buongiorno.
Yeah.
arrivederci.
Now, I don't remember this. Guardians of the Galaxy. Peter Quill says goodbye. I don't remember.
That's, you know, his mom's, like, dying of cancer, I'm pretty sure. And, like, he's just a little kid, and he gets, you know, abducted or whatever.
I don't remember. I remember thinking Guardians of the Galaxy was fun.
Yeah.
Both of them.
The
opening credits of the second one, just ridiculous. Like with Mr. Blue Sky playing and Groot, just little Groot dancing while all hell is breaking loose. Like, and you don't even see that, you know, like what's great about it is that there's this crazy battle going on and you don't see any of it. Like you see like maybe... You see Batista hit the ground or something bounce, and you know it's like some of the things. But meanwhile, it's Mr. Blue Sky, which is one of my favorite songs of all time, and just Groot dancing to it. That's like I love the opening credits of that movie. Now they're doing a third one, right?
Yeah, they brought James Gunn back after they surreptitiously fired him over some tweets. But then people were like, "Come on, man! You know, it was a long time ago." Those tweets were from. Around when he was making Slither, which is one of the grossest movies.
I love that movie.
It's great, but it's just so it's kind of mean and gross and intentionally offensive in many ways. And I'm guessing his head was in a very specific place, and he made some really dumb jokes.
Yeah, I love that movie.
It's great. I mean,
it's a Michael Rooker, man. Yeah. What they do to Michael Rooker in that movie?
It's just a bee sting.
Yeah. And Michael Rooker's great in the Guardians of the Galaxy movies.
Yeah.
I'm Mary Poppins, y'all.
That's one of the most satisfying emotional moments in any of those Marvel movies. He may have been your father, but he weren't your daddy.
Yeah.
Waterworks.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah. Those are fun movies, man.
Super fun.
Yeah.
That's why I'm not a fan of most of the superhero stuff, but I love those.
You like the Guardians of the Galaxy?
Because it feels different.
Yeah.
They're so different from every other movie.
It's weird because my favorite comic book movie is not funny at all. My favorite comic book movie of all time is Logan. And it doesn't feel like a comic book movie. Logan feels like a Western.
A very dark Western.
I love that movie. And the performances are good. The little girl. Hugh Jackman and Patrick Stewart. My God. That is a great... And that's got a great opening scene. That's got a really great opening... the fight scene in the...
Yeah, the fight scene. Yeah.
But the limo.
Yeah.
All right. So Guardians of the Galaxy. Still, I don't remember the opening very much. I do remember the opening of the second one, though. Because of Groot. All right, next they pick A Clockwork Orange. Oh boy, oh boy, yeah, that's a hell of an opening right there. Iconic, man, totally iconic. They're in the Kurova Milk Bar, and yeah, it establishes Alex right away. And you know that look that
the iconic
look, yeah, and the camera pulling back to reveal the rest of the rest of his droogs. You know, a lot of people hate that movie because it's so different than the book.
Yeah, it's just the fact that he leaves out the final chapter. I think that's what really gets, I can't remember the original author's name. Anthony Burgess.
Yeah, Burgess, right.
Yeah, he really was not a fan of that because he's like, this is not how I wanted it to end, but Kubrick wanted to go with the more cynical take on what they were talking about.
Well, I saw a stage version of it. Steppenwolf did it. Did a stage version of Clockwork Orange. Many, many years ago. And it was horrendous. It was horrendous. And it featured like full frontal nudity. And the guy who played Alex was really, he takes off all his clothes. And this guy was very well endowed. And I mean, they spent a lot of money on this production, too. I mean, Steppenwolf, you know? So they spent a lot of money on this production. It rained on stage. You know, they went all out there. But like the audible gasp that happened when he took his pants off, that was like, wait a minute, they spent all this money on special effects, and this is the part where people go, oh! That's the only thing I remember about it. I remember I hated the play, and then the guy was, the lead was well endowed. That's it. That's all I remember about it. One of my favorite quotes about that production. This was like in the mid 90s when they did it. So like 20 almost 25 years ago. So I remember when my friend Steve said it was because at that time the late great Martha Levy was artistic director of Steppenwolf. Lovely woman. Fantastic woman. But my friend Steve said it was like she was artistic director at that time. It was like they walked out on stage. They may as well have just taken a wheelbarrow full of money and just set it on fire on stage. That's
same effect.
That's pretty much what it was.
God, that takes some serious serious brass to want to adapt that for the stage.
Well, there are a couple of I'm friends with a theater company that used to be called Defiant Theater.
Yeah,
and they were known for, well, that's the kind of attitude that they had. They named their theater company Defiant. And they were mostly known, the most popular stuff that they did a play called Action Movie the Play. And they did it, they did three different versions of it. And it was just, because of the fight choreography and the special effects and stuff, it was a huge hit. It was a massive, massive hit for them. And that was like their big, that was kind of their bread and butter. And so they did a production of Clockwork. Tough, man. It's tough. I didn't read the book till after I saw the movie.
Yeah, we read it in high school because it was on, I think at one point it was on a banned book list. It was like,
oh yeah, it was.
Yeah, it was definitely banned for a while. So we did a whole like semester on banned books.
Yeah, that's cool.
It was awesome. It was so
much. What were
fun.
Some of the other ones?
Oh man. Believe it. I mean, Tom Sawyer.
Oh, sure.
Because of the language of the time. And, I think we read. Oh yeah, I can't believe how quickly we read 100 Years of Solitude.
Oh wow,
we read. That's a huge book, and we had to read it quick.
Wow.
But yeah, it was a very, very fun thing to do.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, because it reminds you that at one point, sometimes reading is dangerous in a way. You know, ideas are dangerous. Not just what you can see on the screen; it's what you can see in your head.
Yeah, it's true. I'm trying to. You know, that we had the basic books. You know, that everybody had to read.
Gatsby.
Lord of the Flies.
You know. I do love Lord of the Flies, though.
I do, too. Gatsby, I don't like.
Not a Gatsby person?
No. No. But I like Lord of the Flies. And, I mean, Catcher in the Rye is one of my favorite books, if not my favorite book of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of good... You know, the thing is, like, everybody's like, they associate those books with school, so it seems like a chore, when in fact they're good. There's a reason why you study those books, you know? So, yeah. But now, yeah, I mean, you know, most of the books that we read, you know, that were assigned to us, I liked, except for Gatsby. That's the only one.
If someone were to ask me, hey, what F. Scott Fitzgerald book would you recommend that I read? I would not pick The Great Gatsby.
Yeah. Well, I just think everybody in the book is a jerk.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's kind of the point.
No, I know it is, but I don't want to spend hours, you know, with these people.
I would usually say The Side of Paradise.
Oh, all right. Okay. Well, anyway. But Clockwork Orange.
Great opening.
Yeah. And you know what? We weren't assigned that book. I know a lot of schools did assign Clockwork Orange to read, which, you know, seems edgy.
Yeah, but it's a great language exercise, because one of the things we did with it was you had to make, I think the language was called NADSAT.
Yes.
And you had to make a functioning dictionary of NADSAT.
Yeah.
And that was really
good. Well, that's the thing about that book is, you know, you spend a lot of time going back while you're reading it and then going to the glossary. Like, what?
But it's amazing what your brain will do once you figure out how the language functions. It starts to make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Good book. Good book. Good movie, too. Kubrick. He made a couple of good ones. All right. We have to break here for some weather. We'll do the weather, and then we'll take a break, and we'll come back, and my dad will be here to tell a joke, because it's Monday morning, and it's a laughy, laughy, laugh time.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go with your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey, what'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
Ah, yes, that's right. Now, every Monday morning, we like to start your work week off with a laugh, so my dad calls in and tells a joke. He's been telling jokes his whole life. And we are live in the Skyline studio here, and we're here until 5, and the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. But before we break for that, we got to get a laugh here, and for my dad. So my dad is going to tell a joke. Hey, Dad.
Hi, Matt.
How are you?
Pretty good.
All right.
I'm good.
How's Ma?
Good.
All right. You got a joke?
Ready? Number 270.
Oh, wow. All right.
Then there was a farmer's chicken that started eating racing forms. Now the chickens are laying odds.
All right. All right. All right.
boy, laying odds. All right.
There you go.
All right, Dan. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye.
There you go. Laying odds.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
He'll do it again next week, as he does every Monday. By the way, Marcus Leshock, our good buddy Marcus, is showing the Oscar the Grouch bit from Saturday Night Live. It's really, truly one of the funniest things I've seen on SNL in a long time. Was the pit? Did you see it?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Oh
the
my
grouchy,
god!
The, I feel grouchy.
Yeah,
and it's amazing how they were able to recreate shots like.
Oh yeah,
seriously, the framing and coloration.
For those
was
people
perfect.
Who don't know, they did a parody of Joker over the weekend on SNL. David Harbour was the host, who by the way was great on SNL.
He did. I loved him as the principal, and I'm your principal. Yay, yeah. No.
Yeah. No, he was great. He was very, very funny. And it was, you know, they did a good job. They did a really good job. But the bit that I'm talking about is it's like a commercial parody of Joker, where they captured the whole look and the style of Joker, but it's about Oscar the Grouch. Check it out. I'm sure, you know, it's all over.
It's on YouTube already, yeah,
so,
yeah. For sure.
All right, let's wrap this up. How about this? Citizen Kane. Nobody's mentioned Citizen Kane.
Rosebud.
Yeah.
That's the name of his sleigh.
Yeah. We got another mention of Inglourious Basterds under the floorboards. Oh, man, The Godfather, I Believe in America. I want you to be a man! Jaws, I have the opening here. We're getting close to the top here of the list. Now, I'm sure you will agree with this one. The Lion King.
Oh, yeah.
The Circle of Life.
Come on.
Are we talking about the...
We're talking about The Lion King, not
the original,
whatever.
not the live action Lion King that we were just blessed with.
Yeah, not what the guy from Swingers thought was a good version of The Lion King.
Yeah. Well, these movies are making money, man. We're gonna see.
It's hand over fist.
It's
they're gonna do more.
They're gonna do more live action, you know, remakes of animated classics because they just make a lot. Can you believe the money Aladdin made?
Yeah, it's.
I mean, I just.
Well, for Disney Plus, they're doing Lady and the Tramp, so I don't know how they're gonna. I mean,
well, they're gonna have animatronic dogs. What?
That'd actually be. I'd be more impressed if they were animatronic. They'll just do what they always do.
Yeah,
they're just gonna do CGI dogs, and they're gonna eat CGI spaghetti on a CGI like background. You know,
I love that movie,
Lady and the Tramp.
Yeah, I do. I love it.
Listen, it's no Aristocats, but you know,
oh, come on,
good.
Man. That was 70s. Come on, man. That was 70s Walt Disney. Not a very shiny period in the animation department at Disney.
Yeah, but it's not maybe Oliver and Company, you know.
That was the 80s.
Oh, that was the 80s?
That was 89.
Yeah, well, Billy Joel.
Yeah.
As a singing dog.
Pulp Fiction is mentioned here, the diner robbery at the beginning. Touch of Evil, which we talked about already. Up.
Brutal.
I can't.
So good, but it's brutal.
Oh, Scream. Whoa, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's one of the best opening scenes ever. And, you know, like, what's really amazing about that is that Drew Barrymore was signed on. You know, she's like the biggest name in that movie at that time because this was before Neve Campbell, you know, took her. She was in Party of Five at that point, but she was before, you know, she became a big star. So you've got your big star, Drew Barrymore, dead 5 minutes into the movie or 10 minutes into the movie because that's what Hitchcock did in Psycho.
Yeah, they even made her look like, yeah. You know.
20 minutes into Psycho, gone. Janet Leigh is gone. People were freaked out, man.
Wasn't Drew Barrymore even, she was on the poster, too,
yeah.
For Scream. They really thought that Drew was going to be, if I were in the audience, I would have thought that, too.
That's a great movie, and that opening scene is great.
Mm-hmm.
Really, truly. We got The Dark Knight with the bank heist. Star Wars, long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Oh, well, come on now. I can't believe nobody mentioned this. Raiders.
Oh, yeah.
Raiders of the Lost Ark, one of the greatest opening sequences ever. You know?
I don't think I ever trusted Alfred Molina after that. I was
he ended up dead anyway.
Yeah, he guessed what's coming to him.
No, Raiders of the Lost Ark, that is a great opening scene.
Well, just the transition from the Paramount logo into an actual mountain.
Yeah.
It's cliche now, but at the time, I'm sure it was,
oh, it was
a
cool.
Real crowd plays.
It was very, very cool. They did it in the second one, too.
Yep. Yeah.
Because it was on the big gong that's in the bar, in the musical sequence.
Yeah, in the club.
Yeah. I'm one of the few people on the planet I like the second one the most.
Someone told me that their favorite movie of all time was The Last Crusade.
Why?
I don't know. I was confused. I'm like, well, it's not bad. I'd be wrong to say if it was bad.
I still think Temple of Doom is the best.
Mm-hmm.
And that last one was just with LaBeoufy.
Which is sad because I think Shia LaBeouf's a talented guy.
Oh, I think he's great.
It
was a terrible. You know who's bad in it? Cate Blanchett. And she's never bad. So, all right. And then finally, 2001 Space Odyssey, The Dawn of Man.
Naturally.
It's my favorite segment in the movie.
One of the best cuts of all time.
Yep. Yep. So, hey, listen, tomorrow on the show, it'll be Two for Tuesday, and then Larissa Zagaris and Kitty Curran are going to talk about their new book, For Your Consideration, Keanu Reeves. It's a love letter to Keanu, who's having quite a spectacular time. A couple of pretty transcendent years for Keanu. People are finally catching up to the fact that Keanu rules. I've been on the Keanu boat for a long time, man. So
you've been on since Bill and Ted.
Exactly. Even before that. River's Edge, man. So, okay. Anyway, we'll talk about the authors of For Your Consideration, Keanu Reeves, as part of Two for Tuesday tomorrow. It's going to be a fun show.